Judiciary Committee, February 7, 1977, 1:30 p.m., room 350, case 7, side 2.
Meeting will come to order. The clerk will note those members present, the ballots are absent. House Bill 2257, Laird Kirkpatrick.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Laird Kirkpatrick. My address is School of Law, University of Oregon in Eugene. I am here representing the Oregon State Bar. I'm chairman of the Procedure and Practice Committee, and this is an Oregon State Bar endorsed and recommended bill that was in turn recommended to the bar by the Procedure and Practice Committee. I should explain at the outset that I'm a stand-in for some of the committee members that were to testify on this bill today. Some of the persons assigned to the bill, Frank Day from Portland, Darcy Atherley and Eugene, both had last-minute conflicts and were not able to appear here today. Also, some other attorneys who have been active in testifying to the legislature at the last session and at various bar conventions in favor of this proposed reform are unable to be here today. So if the committee is in need of further testimony by proponents of this legislation, those members have indicated to me that they would be willing to attend the future session if the committee wants to schedule a further hearing on this bill or perhaps to submit written testimony. But I mention that because I believe there may be, it is a controversial bill in the sense that it is opposed by a number of attorneys who may be here today, and I just didn't want to get into a battle of numbers. It might help to explain the position of the bar with regard to this bill by giving a little bit of background. At the 1974 bar convention, a report recommending interrogatories in unlimited number was reported by the Procedure and Practice Committee, and after considerable debate at the annual bar convention in Bend, was endorsed by the bar convention that year. The bill was introduced at the 1975 legislature. It was incorporated into a much broader procedural and discovery reform provision, House Bill 3013, which was basically a committee bill sponsored by Representative Myers. And the bar legislation was incorporated in that bill, which ultimately passed the House and died in the Senate. This time, the Procedure and Practice Committee, rather than recommending the bills that are introduced in 74, instead looked to the House Bill 3013, which did incorporate a number of provisions that had been considered by the House previously, and look to that as the model in drafting the legislation. So the bill that's before you today is very largely based on House Bill 3013, which was considered by this committee at the last session of the legislature, and as I indicated, did pass the House. The committee of the Procedure and Practice Committee consists of 15 members. Three members of that committee dissented to this recommendation to the bar, and at least one of those committee members will be here today, plus some other members who are not on that committee. The procedure, this proposal was very much debated at the bar convention last fall, and again, a majority of the bar endorsed the proposal. But I'm giving you this background to explain what the position is and that the bar, and that the majority of the bar has endorsed the measure twice, that the concerns and criticisms that have been raised of the interrogatories have been considered both by the Procedure and Practice Committee and by the bar as a whole. And so it simply was the feeling of the committee that we didn't need to balance the number of opponents to this bill by bringing down all the proponents. And I feel perhaps this background will explain what the sentiment of the bar has been with regard to this measure without necessarily having to bring in the 12 members of the committee that supported it to testify in opposition to the dissenters. In light of that background, I'd like to turn to the merits of the bill. The bill is introduced and recommended because Oregon currently has no interrogatory provisions as such. There is a statute, ORS 45.320-370, that provides for taking depositions on written questions, but it's a very cumbersome statute, requires the appointment of a person who's authorized to as a commissioner, the exclusion of counsel for the party and have to get a court order to obtain the deposition by that method is really not what is considered an interrogatory provision. So Oregon is one of a relatively small number of states that has no provision for interrogatories at all, regardless of the type of proceeding, regardless of the availability of other means of discovery or the prohibitive costs of other forms of discovery. Oregon simply does not have a interrogatory statute. The majority of other states do have interrogatory procedures that are much, in many cases, modeled after the federal rule provision, which is Federal Rule 33. The federal rules are very liberal with regard to discovery generally, and certainly with regard to interrogatories. And approximately half the states have based their interrogatory procedures on Federal Rule 23. The proposed legislation you have before you in House Bill 2257 is, although it's modeled after Federal Rule 33, is much more limited. It restricts the number of interrogatories that may be served by any party upon an opposing party in an action suit or proceeding to 25, with each subpart counting as one interrogatory, unless the court in which the action suit or proceeding is pending allows a greater number upon a showing of good cause. As I indicated before, at the 1975 session, the bill that was approved by this committee and passed the House did not have any ceiling at all on the number of interrogatories. But because of concerns that have been expressed by some attorneys at the bar convention and within the committee, it was felt by a majority of our committee that it would be better to limit the number of interrogatories that could be taken without court order to 25, so that the bill you have is already a compromised bill. I mean, in other words, the viewpoints of the opponents have been considered, and the concern about the burdensome possibilities of interrogatories have been taken into consideration. Certainly, it would be unfair for law firms that have a MagCart typewriter to press a button and deluge somebody with 500 or 700 pattern interrogatories in every case, regardless of the size of the litigation. So this is why there is a feeling that the number of interrogatories should be limited. The reason why interrogatories are often among the most valuable types of discovery are that interrogatories are so much more less expensive than depositions. Depositions can easily run into the hundreds of dollars. There's not only the cost per page, but the appearance fee by the court reporter. And so in certain types of cases, depositions are simply prohibitive. In some cases, certainly not always, but in some cases, by having interrogatories available, it will obviate the need and the expense of depositions. By having interrogatories, it's possible to gain more information about the opponent's case and therefore ensure that each side is fully prepared at trial and that the cases are more likely to be based on the merits of each side's case rather than upon elements of surprise. In absence of liberal discovery provisions, it could happen that the trial is decided by surprise evidence by one side that the other side simply didn't have an opportunity to anticipate or rebut, whereas if there's full and open discovery, the feeling is that there's much more likely to be a just result based on the merits of each side's case. Furthermore, there's the general feeling among states that have expanded their pretrial discovery provisions, which includes Oregon, and certainly very much the movement throughout the country, that by having liberal pretrial discovery provisions, this will encourage settlement. If parties know more about each other's case, they are more likely to make a realistic assessment of the merits of the case and what a realistic a settlement figure might be, and thereby encourage settlements. There's also a feeling that by having interrogatories, it's possible to find out what the truly disputed issues or undisputed issues are, and to eliminate the litigation of undisputed issues, and make sure that the trial proceeds only on issues that are truly in controversy between the litigants. All these arguments could lead to less expense and lower cost of litigation and shorter trials. This may not be true in every case, but certainly the general support that expanding pretrial discovery has received is based upon these general policy considerations. I would be pleased to go through a section-by-section breakdown of the bill, if the committee would like. I do have a statement prepared that indicates where the different sections of the bill come from and what they purport to do. Would the committee like me to proceed through the bill section by section at this time?
Committee, desire that detail of testimony at this point from Mr. Hershacker? I don't believe that'll be necessary.
Okay, well, I will have that in the prepared statement. I think perhaps the most important, which I will submit to the committee afterwards, that indicates where the various sections are derived and what their purpose is intended to be, although I think most of them are self-evident. I will make a few general comments that, first of all, this bill is modeled after Federal Rule 33 to a large extent, but not totally. I think you will hear from the opponents that this is an example of piecemeal adoption of the federal rules. And I just want to make a couple of comments about that. First of all, it's the opinion of the committee that there's nothing necessarily wrong with incorporation of the federal rules or looking to the federal rules as a model. As I say, half the states in the country are using the federal rules or have based their state procedural rules upon the federal rules. And in the opinion of many commentators, they are the most advanced types of procedure. So to be a federal rule is not necessarily anything negative. However, the committee is not making this recommendation because it's a federal rule. I think the majority of the committee would not recommend that the federal rules be adopted in toto. In other words, the committee position is a middle ground. We're not saying that we should reject something because it's a federal rule or that we should adopt something because it's a federal rule. In our opinion, piecemeal adoption and independent examination of the federal rules is the most responsible way to proceed. And that is what the committee has attempted to do here. Federal Rule 33 has been used as a model, but it was felt that Federal Rule 33 in its the exact form it's used in federal court would be inappropriate for state procedures. And that's why one change was that the number of interrogatories was limited to 25. In various other ways, the bill before you is not quite as expansive as Federal Rule 33. For example, the sanction provisions under Federal Rule 33 or Federal Rule 37 when enforcing Federal Rule 33 provide that attorney's fees shall be awarded against a losing party when a motion to compel is made in absence of certain mitigating circumstances, whereas the bar bill changes that language from shall to may. There are various other less significant, perhaps, changes between this bill and Federal Rule 33 and Federal Rule 37, but I just am mentioning that to indicate that this is not an attempt by the committee to adopt a federal rule or the federal rules in toto. It's based upon independent examination by a bar committee and by the bar as a whole of what procedure might be useful in Oregon. So that is the background, the origin of the bill, and an explanation of why the bar feels this type of procedure is needed. I would be pleased to answer any questions the committee may have.
Could you take just a second to note exactly the departures from Rule 33 that are in here, in addition to those you've already noted? The limitation to 25 is one. Do you have it on?
Okay.
Is that in your presentation?
It is in the presentation. Section by section.
Okay, we can see that in the written presentation.
As the committee will note, this bill does go beyond simply interrogatories in that it also provides for a definition of the scope of discovery. Oregon has had a tremendous gap in its existing discovery procedures, and that there's no statement of what the scope of discovery is. How far can a person go in a deposition in terms of asking questions? There was at one time supposed to be the federal rule that would govern this procedure, and it's passed the legislature as part of a section of ORS 45181, and then the second part of that legislation was left out. So there's this reference in Oregon statutes right now to this non-existent provision governing the scope of discovery. This bill remedies that. It goes beyond interrogatories, but it simply establishes a general statement taken from the federal rules that establishes the scope of discovery. In addition, there's no general provision in Oregon law governing dealing with hardship or abuse in taking discovery. There's a provision in 45181 that deals with preventing hardship or abuse in depositions. This section is repealed by the bill, and a more general statement that applies to all forms of discovery is substituted in its stead. So there are those two additional changes that go beyond interrogatories that are encompassed in this bill. They also are repeated in House Bill 2259, which is coming up later. There are some overlapping provisions. The bills were drafted this way so that these provisions would be adopted even if both bills did not pass. In other words, the bar broke up what was House Bill 3013 last time into three separate bills, and those three separate bills are House Bill 2257, 58, and 59.
Representative Gardner?
It's been a long time since I've studied the federal rules. How does Section 4 of the bill relate to the scope of discovery under the federal rules? Is it the same, or...?
Yes, that provision is exactly the same as Federal Rule 26 B1, 26B1, that's just the exact language from the current federal rule defining the scope of discovery. The bar bill does not, this bill does not go on and adopt all of Rule 26. Federal Rule 26 goes on to define work products and describe whether expert testimony is discoverable and insurance limits and so forth, and this bill does not go that far, but it does take the first step and adopt the first section of the federal rule verbatim.
Further questions? Representative Frommeyer?
Yeah, Larry, just 45181 talks about protecting the rights of parties and of witnesses from embarrassment and so forth, whereas 2257 refers just to the rights of parties. And I take it that that's because interrogatories may only be had of parties, people who are admitted either voluntarily or involuntarily as parties. Is that correct?
That's correct, although since this statute is designed to replace the general provision, 45181, I think your point is an excellent one, and I think it should extend to witnesses, too. Interrogatories are limited to parties, as you say, so it doesn't make any difference in the context of this bill. But if it is adopted and 45181 is repealed, I think that the language should be added to protect witnesses also. I think your point's a good one.
Well, it seemed to me that that was something worth worrying about, and I take it that's because 45181 refers both to depositions and interrogatories,
that's
and
true.
That under present Oregon practice, you'd have to protect the rights of witnesses in depositions. But this bill didn't read that way, and I just wanted to make clarification of the apparent anomaly.
No, I there was no intent by the bar to take away the, or conscious intent to take away the protection from witnesses. It was just that this was drafted in the context of interrogatories, which don't cover witnesses, but I think it would have an effect on witnesses in the deposition situation, and that protection should be kept in the bill.
Mr. Chairman, one last question. Under existing Oregon practice, and I admit to being a neophyte in this, can a witness at any point ever be served interrogatories now?
No. Other than taking a deposition upon interrogatories, this very, but that's not really an interrogatory procedure.
Okay. Thank you.
Further questions? Thank you. Counsel?
My name is Wendell Gronso. I practice law in Burns, Oregon. And I thank the committee for giving me a few minutes to speak in opposition to the interrogatories. The last speaker, Mr. Kirkpatrick, mentioned the background of this. I was on the Procedure and Practice Committee of the Oregon State Bar more than 10 years ago. And this is something that has been kicking around, and there's some want it and some don't want it. He's also stated that the majority of the bar want written interrogatories. Well, unfortunately, as probably all of you know, the bar meets in an annual convention. There's about 5,000 members of the Oregon State Bar. I was unable to be at Gearhart last year, so I don't know how many people were present, but most of these things are someplace between 20 and 60 people present, and one big law firm can really pack this thing so that that comes out that the bar, that is the bar's recommendation. Maybe it's proper, maybe those of us that weren't there to vote serves us right, but it's a long ways from Burns to Gearhart, and it just happened that we couldn't make it this year, and I'm certain that most of the bar members were not there. I know they weren't there, so I don't know what the majority of the bar says, but I do feel, and from experience in both federal court and state court, that we better stop and take a look at ourselves in our common law system, or we're going to price ourselves completely out of existence. And every time another procedural matter such as interrogatories is injected into our system, it takes more time, and it doesn't. And it's going to take more time, and I'll bet you my boots on it, and anybody that practices both in federal court and state court, if they'll actually keep track of their time, I think they will agree that it will take more time in federal court. And one of the reasons is interrogatories, because you're going to get them. And somebody's going to pay for this time. Now, we talked about the high cost of justice. We talked about lawyers making too much money. Maybe some of us do, and maybe some of us don't. But the time, it's the litigant in the court system that is going to actually pay for these extra things. And it's going to take more time for judges if House Bill 2257 is passed. You just land through it. And if there's objections, it goes before the court. If there's objections to the interrogatories, well, that takes time, and it takes the court's time. If there's objections that the answers aren't proper, then you go before the court. You read through the first three sections of House Bill 2257, and most of it is how you go before the cost and who's going to, how you go before the court and who's going to pay the cost of it. And that is a real thing that is involved in every lawsuit. And we have got the cost of lawsuits too high now. I've heard an insurance man, a claims manager for the West Coast, of an insurance company state that it takes 8% of the premium dollar for defense costs. And that's because the time of the lawyer is taking. We're spending a lot of money, we're needing, and I know that you have requests for more judges every session of the legislature. This type of thing is going to take more of the judges' time. And there's just no way you can get around it. And you're going to get the 25 interrogatories. The first speaker said, well, it'd be unfair to have for the law firm that has the IBM typewriter to make 40 or 50 or 100 or 500 interrogatories in every case, but you're going to get the 25, and you can bet your boots on it, from most firms. And there's law book companies. You get the advertisement in the mail saying, here's our canned interrogatories. You just pick them out and have your girl type them up. Then the other side has to get the client in, and you have to dig it out, and you have to answer. And interrogatories do not necessarily take the surprise out. If the other side has a surprise for you and you don't know how to frame the interrogatory because you don't know what they have, the specific point of the interrogatory is not going to get to it. And I would urge that the committee do not pass on this bill because I believe in my own mind it is going to increase the cost of litigation to the litigants and take up more of the court's time. Is there any questions?
Mr. Killengoff?
Mr. Grasso, I want to apologize for something I've been highly critical of, is that the practicing bar many times it does not take an interest in the bills before the legislature, and I'm somewhat impressed that you'd make the trip all the way from Burns to express your opinion on this particular bill, and though I have voiced criticism in the past about it, I think still maybe that you're the exception rather than the rule. But
well,
I appreciate you coming all the way over here to do that.
Further questions? Representative Rutherford?
Mr. Johnson, the previous speaker indicated that he thought there would be some cost saving using written interrogatories as opposed to depositions. Could you comment on that, please?
Well, it's been my experience that you get the deposition and the interrogatory every blame time I get into federal court. That happens. Now, there may be the rare case with the rare lawyer where one interrogatory would do the job. But that's not the way the lawyers seem to play the game, I'm ashamed to say. For some reason, we get the full batch in every case, whether it's a $1,000 case or a $1,000,000 case. And in the long run, it just doesn't save time. From my nearly 30 years' experience in trying cases in both federal and state court.
Thank you.
Grasso, you take into account the limitation to 25 in your remarks?
Yes, I certainly have. But whether it's 1 or 25 or 500, you still have to get the client in. You still have to sit down and answer the blame thing. And if there's a one that can't be answered or one that's asking for privileged matters, you still have to go before the court. It doesn't make any difference in it. Well, it is going to make some difference on the number of them. But you still is going to make a little more thought have to go into the person asking the interrogatory. Frankly, I've never seen well-written interrogatories on any case that 25 wouldn't do it, but you'll get 80 or 100 of them because somebody does have a Magdart typewriter and they ask them in the last case. But you still go through the same motions.
I would gather that the 25 limitation is intended to try to force a certain discipline on lawyers who are intending to use them and to try to restrict them to the really basic kind of functions they can serve.
Yes, but then...
including names of witnesses and information of that sort.
Yes, but you're going to get into the privilege matters. You're still going to get into the things that you're going to have to go before the court on. And we've got a horrible jam in our courts. And every time we put one more of these things in, let me just give you an example. Last legislature passed a summary judgment bill. And frankly, I thought that was a dandy bill. I thought it would save time. But it worked just the other way. You're getting a motion for a summary judgment time after time that's not well taken. But you have to go through the motions and prepare for it and have a hearing and go before the court. And 3 years ago when that bill was passed, I thought it was good. I actually did. And I can see now that it's just added more time.
Representative Blumenauer.
I was just curious, sir, if there were any circumstances under which you feel that the use of written interrogatories could advance the cause of judicial economy, as it were. From what you've said, there's no advantage whatsoever to this bill and to the current practice in federal courts. Is that a fair statement of your...
No.
Would you tell us then if there are any advantages?
There are cases where it would be nice to be able to use an interrogatory, but we lawyers, for some reason, just don't use self-restraint. And you're going to get 25... one side is going to ask 25 interrogatories, and to even it up, the other side gets 25 interrogatories. It's my experience that you can usually get it by deposition, or if it's just one question that you really want to know. There are several lawyers here from Portland, Tom Cooney, for example. He's on the other end of the case, and I need one question to ask. I'll call him, and I'll say, Tom, I'll either take the deposition, your man, or you tell me this, and 9 times out of 10, you'll tell me, and that takes care of it. And I don't, in other words, on weighing the equities, there are cases, if used properly, interrogatories would be a help, but it's the burden that is imposed far outweighs the usefulness of it or any time.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Blumenauer,
I just wonder if you would elaborate on those circumstances under which it would be helpful. Just
well, for example, you have a products liability case, and you want to know the name of the manufacturer of the widget that blew up in your face that you bought from the drugstore. And it'd be real nice to be able to file suit against the drugstore and file one interrogatory and find out that manufacturer in that particular case. But you can take the deposition and you can get it. And 9 times out of 10, the other lawyer, if he knows, he'll tell you who the manufacturer was anyhow. So there are cases where it would be useful.
But not essential.
But not essential, no.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Gardner?
Might this be a method for a poor man's deposition? You have a case that maybe is a marginal case and it would cost you $50 or $100 in cost to take a deposition, and the amount of information that you needed was minimal, and wouldn't you be able to perhaps get that by carefully worded interrogatories?
It would work real nice, except that every time it seemed like that I get the poor man, the other fellow smells that, and he deluges me with the depositions, with the interrogatories, and the whole ball of wax. And if you have the poor man's lawsuit, you just have an extra burden, because these interrogatories work both ways. I get the one piece of information with one or two interrogatories, and I get 25 of them to answer, still have to go through the depositions.
Well, but might there be cases in which you would not take a deposition where you might take the interrogatories because of the cost. It seems like the cost is minimal to send out 25 questions by mail, as opposed to having a court reporter come in and recording the testimony and having that reproduced.
That part's true, but you're still not going to avoid the deposition if the other party asks for your client's deposition.
But they can do that anyway, can't they?
Right. But the other party is going to dump 25 interrogatories on you, and he's probably going to ask you some questions that you feel that he is not entitled to ask. So you have to file a motion objected to him and go before the court, and then have the court settle it. And then you give an answer, and the other side objects the answer that it's evasive or not to the point, and then you go back before the court. And you end up with more time involved. And it's a poor man's lawsuit that I'm worried about. The reason that I did feel that strongly enough on this that I came from Burns.
Further questions?
Thank you.
Is it Mr. Hick?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Charles Schilke. I'm the director of the Legal Aid Office here in Salem, and I came to testify specifically in response to the questions that Representative Gardner had asked. I believe, in terms of our practice, that the only way we would be able to get discovery is in terms of the passage of this bill, which would allow us to ask interrogatories. Presently, we would have to request a deposition be taken. Our clients generally cannot pay for a deposition. We have developed a technique of taking depositions by tape recorder. We sometimes have to go to a hearing in order to get a court order to allow us to take it by tape recorder. And the individual that operates the tape recorder must be able to swear the witnesses. The problem in the case of doing it with tape recorders is then that the office staff has to then produce the deposition. And because of the volume of cases that we deal with, we only infrequently are able to use the tape recording system. So I think it would result in a savings of costs to the indigent or poor man's lawsuit. And as such, I specifically would commend the committee to pass this legislation. And my recommendation that you do pass this legislation is specifically because the interrogatories are limited to 25. In the course of our practice, we have sometimes represented, specifically in domestic relations suits, parties that are from another state, and we frequently get interrogatories to answer in regard to that kind of suit. Some states do not limit the interrogatories, and they are indeed extremely burdensome to answer. But I think the limit of interrogatories to 25 is a means of protection. I would also say in general that while there may be difficulties in terms of whether or not a specific question should be answered or a specific interrogatory answered, and that leads then to the extensive procedure to determine whether or not the question is burdensome or necessary or relevant or within the scope of the lawsuit, that is not a sufficient reason not to pass the legislation. I think the legislation, House Bill 2257, properly used, results in a savings. If it is not properly used, it's like any other court procedure. It's just simply not going to be used at that point. It's burdensome. But in terms of our specific representation, we are not able to get discovery in terms of the clients that we represent because they are not able to afford it, and we do not have the office staff to reduce the tape recordings to deposition form. And that is really the purpose of my testimony, was specifically from the indigent's point of view.
Well, as I understand what you're saying, I don't gather the stress so much on cost savings, but that you are in effect excluded from
even minimally effective discovery in some cases.
Precisely.
These interrogatories might help
precisely
avoid or resolve. Further questions? Representative Rutherford?
You don't feel then that this would be oppressive so far as your clients were concerned in connection with answering these interrogatories?
It's actually easier for us to receive a written interrogatory in the office, request the client to come in, and then go ahead and just have them answer it in the office, rather than trying to make our client available for a deposition with all the parties appearing at one place at one time. It actually results in a savings of time for us. Now, it's also true that we generally do not deal in extremely complex litigation in a products liability case or that kind of litigation. Most complex litigation that we would be involved in are generally with administrative agencies, and so that there may be a distinction in terms of complex litigation. But in those cases, I think in general, the clients are going to have the money to pay for discovery, which you would do anyway, in a deposition form.
Other questions? Representative Dugas?
What have you to say about Mr. Gonzo's remark that usually the interrogatory on one side sort of elicits interrogatories on the other side, you're going to get in a tit-for-tat situation.
That, I have not seen that occur, but of course we're not using the interrogatories right now. In federal court, I have not seen that occur. Specifically, we have filed interrogatories in regard to civil rights cases requesting the state to answer certain questions. That has not, in that case, led to an interrogatory for our party to answer certain questions. It may be, in terms of the abuse of the procedure, that as the previous witness testified, that when you file interrogatories on one side, the other side attempts to get even by filing interrogatories also. As a practical matter, that should then at least allow the parties to enter into a stipulation on some facts to reduce the length of the trial. And this is, in my viewpoint, what is happening in federal courts, which have essentially now become a paper trial. The problem in federal courts is they don't limit the number of depositions, which is why I specifically want the number limited. But I have not experienced the other side requesting interrogatories.
Further, Mr. Chairman, the other point that he made, which seemed fairly strong to me, was the one about having to eventually take your difference on an interrogatory to the court and just consuming more time and actually sort of trying the case twice, once on paper and then once in the courtroom. What do you say about that? Haven't you run it? You indicate you have some experience with this with your client. Have you not run into this sort of thing?
We have not, and it may be specifically because the state has generally been on the other side of the interrogatories that we have filed. They have not accepted to the interrogatories to require us to go up to Portland to argue whether or not those questions should be answered. I think it really depends on the good faith of the lawyers involved. If you're going to ask a question that requires them to produce documentation back until 1967, then of course you're going to have some problems with it. But, I mean, my opinion is that the procedure properly used would help in the representation of indigents.
Representative Trenmeyer?
Don't you think it would be, with reference to this last consideration, don't you think it would be true, though, that since the bill does contain provisions for the court assessing fees and costs against the party who necessitated a court appearance, that there is a built-in deterrence factor against the bad faith objection to an interrogatory?
There certainly would be, and in our particular situation, I would guess that, you know, if there was any merit at all, we'd have to back off because our clients would not be able to afford the attorney fees on the other side. So that would naturally act as a deterrent in an indigent or a poor man's suit.
I guess then my own experience in federal court that judges really whip the attorneys into shape pretty fast on bad faith objections, and that it would result in an assessment of costs, and that consequently attorneys are quite careful about the degree to which they took their objections to the court and didn't broker them out or work them out amicably.
And it's extremely embarrassing to be taken to task in front of a number of attorneys like that.
Representative Ungarski.
The limitation of 25 questions that you asked about, since the federal rules have no limitation on the questions, do you know of any state that has adopted the interrogatory concept that have a limitation on the questions asked?
I cannot give you a specific citation, but I believe Massachusetts has limited the number, and I'm not sure whether that number is 25, but the state of Massachusetts, I'm quite sure, has limited the number of interrogatories.
Two things, Charlie, Mr. Chairman, that concern me. One is that with the limitation, that there's some belief that the truth or whatever you're trying to arrive at is some way ascertainable within 25 questions, and I don't necessarily know if that's actually correct. And then I guess the argument to that would be that there's a provision in there that the court could allow you to ask more questions upon a showing of good cause. And it would appear to me that just in my limited trial practice at my young age is that that's the type of question that most judges that I know would not be willing to answer in the negative. That in the fact that if you could just say that I need to ask this question, that they're going to be more inclined to say, go ahead and ask it. And that really, the limitation, though it looks good on paper, and I understand why it's there, but in reality, I do not see that being a limitation on the number of interrogatories that would be asked.
First of all, in the kinds of litigation that we're involved in, I don't see why you would not be able to ask to get the information within the 25 questions. Secondly, I would expect that if this legislation was enacted and the limitation was to 25, because of the previous non-experience with interrogatories by the state judiciary, that it would be somewhat difficult to get them to extend the interrogatories. Now, I'm surmising, speculating, but that would be my speculation.
I guess every time I've seen an objection made on relevancy or materiality, that there's always seems to be a 20-minute argument by the attorneys on whether it's relevant or not, and then if you make even a colorable argument at all, the court judges are willing, it appears to me, to say, well, listen, go ahead and ask your question, but then they reserve to cut you off at some particular point if you have not been able to show for what is intended. But I just have problems with the limitation, basically on the philosophy that some way truth is ascertainable in a number of questions, whereas it would, if it was 28 or 29, that may be somewhere difficult to handle.
It may not be ascertainable in 25 questions, but certainly the area of dispute may be narrowed.
Yeah, I think there's really a lawsuit in which 25 good interrogatories can't elicit an awful lot of information, even in the most complex cases.
And the savings may result when you actually try the case, if you've narrowed down on which facts are an issue.
Further questions?
Just one.
Representative from there.
I've seen interrogatories that ask question one and then have five subparts, A, B, C, D, and E. Do those count as one question or as six?
I believe in section one, subsection two, I believe, that each subpart counts as one interrogatory. That's line 14, page 2.
Right. I've got it.
Further questions? Thank you. Earl Green.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Earl Green. I'm a practicing lawyer in Portland, Oregon. My address is Jackson Tower. Let me speak generally in opposition to this bill initially. I'm appearing for myself. I'm not appearing for any organizational law. I am a member of the Practice and Procedure Committee, and I have been a member of the Practice and Procedure Committee in previous years. This bill, in one form or another, has been before the bar and the state legislature, to my knowledge, at least for 22 years. Until recently, it was almost uniformly defeated by the state bar. And for the previous time I served on the Practice and Procedure Committee, it was defeated at the committee level. Now, I think, to my knowledge, I practiced, well, I'll start over again. My practice is strictly limited to representing plaintiffs in personal injury cases of all types. Workers' compensation through products liability, automobile, and medical malpractice. I don't know of any plaintiff lawyer who consistently practiced plaintiff's law that is in favor of the interrogatory. The defense practicing trial bar is split. The lawyers that vote on this at the state bar meeting are not primarily trial lawyers. They have not really had the experience in the federal system where these interrogatories are in use. I don't have any recent figures, but some 5 years ago, we made a rough compilation in our office trying to calculate the difference in cost. I'm talking about out-of-pocket expenses between a federal court case and a state court case. And they ran between 40% and 65% more cost on a federal court case of the very same nature. Now that doesn't count the hours spent, because representing plaintiffs, we charge only a contingent fee. We do not charge by the hour. This is out-of-pocket expenses. I can't represent to this committee what my current ratio is, because I have not run it down in the last 5 years. And as I say, that was a rough compilation. Generally, this last gentleman that spoke, apparently his experience at federal court is pretty well limited to where the state is a defendant. My experience is I have never yet had a case in federal court after answering all the interrogatories they wanted answered that they did not want to take the plaintiff's deposition. And it's only natural. A trial lawyer is going to want to look at the plaintiff, and I'm going to want to look at the defendant and see what kind of witness they're going to make, if nothing else. See how they respond to questioning. So you're always going to be taking a deposition. Now, as far as the cost of deposition, there is experiment and also quite a bit of experience now, particularly in California, that I'm aware of, where this is put on tape. You can have the person swearing the witness, put it on tape, and you don't have the cost of a court reporter. So the cost factor is of deposition can be eliminated if you wish to do it that way. As a practical matter, so far that's a new development, and as a practical matter, I don't think too many lawyers in Oregon, to my knowledge, are using that. In answer to Representative Blumenhauer's question, there are some cases that I would like to have the interrogatories. If I'm talking about a product liability case, I want to find out who is the engineer who initiated the idea of this particular product. What is their quality control program? Who is in charge of that? That would be easier to get a background by interrogatory. But I feel you have to balance the interests, and the interests of the people that I represent, who normally do not have any money, are against having the interrogatories, whether it be 25 or whether they be 100. Now, I did not have the opportunity over the weekend to have the bill in front of me, but I assume that this bill is the same as proposed by the Practice and Procedure Committee. And so I did try to make some specific points in the bill, if I could take a moment to change glasses. If you get to a certain age, you have to have two sets of glasses. If you study this measure, I count the possibility of 8 actual court hearings. Now, this is not a trial. This is hearing. Did you have to go up to court, have a judge to make a decision, and then come back and abide by that decision? Section 1, number 2, if a party wants a shorter or longer time than 30 days to answer, you've got to ask the court to permission. That's one. Also, in subsection 2, if there is an objection or a failure to answer an interrogatory. you go to court and have that determined. In section 2, subsection 2A and B, there is a hearing on payment of expenses, including attorney's fees, as part of the expenses. It has to be decided by a judge. Section 2, subsection 3, failure to comply with the order allows the court to do any of a number of things. Now, although it doesn't specify that these, that a hearing is required, the court could not possibly do the any of the those specified in that subsection without having the lawyers argue out what their position is. So that has to be another hearing. Section 2, number 4, another hearing on expenses and attorney's fees for failure to comply with a court order. So that has to be argued out. The sixth one, section 4, subsection 1, a motion for protective order. Who's going to make that decision? If the lawyers can't agree, the judge is going to have to make it. That's another appearance. Section 4, subsection 2, another hearing on expenses and attorney's fees if there is a denial of the protective order. A hearing. And the last, if a party wants more than 25 interrogatories, he has to ask the court to do it. So that's eight times that you possibly, on every case, could possibly come before a court and nothing be accomplished except have certain interrogatories answered and then maybe get an attorney's fee. I have another specific objection, section 2, subsection 3, subsection B. That allows commenting on the evidence by the judge. And that's great in the federal system. I don't like it, but it's always been in the federal system where the judge has much more control over a case, is allowed to inject himself into the trial, and much more so than in the state system. But in our state system, the state of Oregon, it's always been a law, the judge does not comment on the evidence. And this would allow that to be done, at least in this narrow particular. One more comment. I find, personally, no more settlement, no higher percentage of settlement in federal court than I do in state court. And I don't know any figures that would show that, or any statistics I've ever seen that would show that interrogatories promote settlement. It's a nice statement to make, but I don't think it's necessarily true. Interrogatories promote time. Now, my client doesn't pay me for my time, but the other side gets paid for their time, and I'm sure that there's many, many squawks about the increased cost of litigation, and this is going to increase it far more. Now, when I say 40 to 65%, I fully agree and understand that's not all due to interrogatory. But, and I did not break it down as to how much of that 40 to 65% higher cost was due to interrogatories. It just, the federal system, which if we adopt this, we pretty much adopted our federal system, and it's just it's going to increase.
Earl, do you file many cases initially in federal court? Where you can
The very last place I want to be.
Is that because of the discovery?
That's because of discovery. Well, a number of things, Mr. Chairman. The discovery is the primary one. Secondly, the judge picks the jury. And third, it has to be unanimous verdict. And I think those militate against, well, plus their system about all the everything in writing. Your witness has to be, your expert has to be presented in writing instead of in person.
So, you would typically wind up in federal court by removal in a diversity case.
That's right, sir.
And would those normally be the larger cases you file?
Not necessarily. Just if the defense counsel prefers federal court, that's where we end up.
You, I gather from what you said, you don't have an analysis of the, a detailed analysis of the discrepancy in cost between state and federal litigation.
I, just the gross. And that's your question. I did not break it down to the interrogatories. requests for admissions, the gathering of expert testimony, and so forth and so on. And we just know, well, I give an example, Mr. Chairman. We were sent up about a month and a half ago from California, a case of Lowe versus Burlington Northern. It's a simple FVLA case. A man fell off the back of the end of a truck on the way to the railroad site. Really, that's all there is to it. The file had to be 4 inches thick. The file in California, the railroad got it removed, saying it was an shooting file in Oregon. So that's how he got involved in it. And it's just the interrogatories and extensive depositions on the California system, which is the federal system. And that's what happens. We would have that case, have a file a little thicker than this pad of paper, and go to trial on it. They've been messing around for 2 years, 2.5 years with it down in California. So long that they had to get a special order that the statute of limitations would be waived, that they got it removed to Oregon. That's a 3-year statute on the FVLA, as you probably know.
Representative Gardner.
Would your comments still be the same as far as the cost that you attribute to the interrogatories, with the thought that by limiting the number of interrogatories to 25, there might be lesser areas of dispute, less reasons under those 8 situations that you discussed to go to court, less time that would be taken with the client to answer those? Would that change your opinion at all, or mitigate?
25 would limit, obviously, the actual cost of out-of-pocket expense as compared to 200. It would limit the cost. If you have a paying client that's paying you X number of dollars per hour, it would be some limitation on that. But not that much, because you're still going to have the client in, make your objection. If you feel disordered, go up to court. It's not going to, I don't think, limit the number of times you're going to go to court, just because it's 25 instead of 200 questions. But it would limit the out-of-pocket expense and, to some extent, the time expense.
Mr. Chairman, in all those 8 different situations that you talked about, that you go to court, some of those provide for attorney's fees in some cases. Wouldn't the fact that attorney's fees might be granted be a deterrent from the attorney attempting to bring it before the court?
They have it in federal court now, and I don't, on the cases I've had, as I say, I try to keep out of federal court. When I get there, I seem to be always up there. If they're arguing before Judge Juba as to whether this is a proper or improper answer, proper question, improper question, and I have not, either against me or against my opponent, been assessed costs or expenses. I've heard of it being done. I'm not saying it doesn't. It isn't done. But I don't think that really restricts it that much.
Representative Farmer.
Well, this is just a concern that first occurred to me when Mr. Gromso testified, and then you reiterated it. It goes to the credibility or level of deference that we as a committee ought to give to the bar's recommendations, and I guess both you and Mr. Gromso have to some degree attempted to impeach the bar's, either the committee work or the convention, by saying it's not representative or not that many people vote or a large law firm is there or whatever. And I suppose I'm familiar enough with the bar to know that it is somewhat uneven in the attention it gives to proposals, but that really throws us at sea as a committee in terms of attempting to second-guess where the bar is, or, on the other hand, to say, look, if the bar's committee has had it, and this is the way the majority of the committee concluded over a period of many months of deliberation, maybe we ought to accept that as a statement of the reasoned opinion of the majority of the bar. What guidance would you give us other than the public opinion poll of the bar with respect to attempting to represent what is or is not the
Sure, that would be the answer even. I'm not attempting to impeach the committee's recommendation. I'm just opposed to it, and have been for years and years, and on the same grounds. This this bill indirectly has come before the legislature on rulemaking power in the Supreme Court. And it's the reason I think it's been defeated is because by giving the Supreme Court rulemaking power in other states, interrogatories have been one of their early rules. And many lawyers in Oregon are opposed to it. And we convinced the legislature that it shouldn't be done. A vote of the bar of 5,000 members, I'm not sure how it would come out, and I don't think that's really the answer. I think if you took the maybe a vote of the trial bar, you took a vote of lawyers that tried maybe a dozen cases a year or more before the jury and see what their reaction is. That would be a more meaningful vote than a vote of the total bar. Or the defense counsel. Now, as I see, my defense lawyers are somewhat split. I don't think any plaintiff's lawyers really are in favor of interrogatory just because the time that they're not getting paid for and the burden that is imposed by interrogatory. So I'm not trying to preach anything. I really didn't intend to give that impression.
Well, I would gather that legal aid lawyers, at least some, are in favor of it.
I gather that on the...
Of course, they're degenerating cases, I realize, but...
Right, and as I understand from this gentleman's testimony, it was a pretty limited area that it got involved in federal court for the state was party. I'm not sure about that, but that's what I gather from this testimony.
Further questions,
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Lombard.
Has the Oregon chapter of ATLA taken a formal position on...
No, sir.
...interrogatories? In your customary contingent fee case, I'm curious, what are the out-of-pocket expenses that you customarily charge back to the client? What are they in the case of interrogatories?
Well, as I say, I did not break that down. If the interrogatories of your expert witness, your talking maybe $300-$400 there.
Would you say that again?
If it's interrogatory of your expert witness, if you're submitting interrogatories to your, say, as an engineer or traffic engineer or chemical engineer or civil engineer, whatever that might be, for his time to give answer to those interrogatories, you're talking, I'm roughly guessing out $300-$400 depending on the length of the interrogatories. The length of the conference to have with him before their answer, that would be the primary cost. Now, the interrogatory, or even the deposition, if your expert is going to be the same kind of cost. The interrogatory to the party plaintiff is just a time-consuming problem.
So, as between the parties, then, isn't the out-of-pocket cost really your cost, in other words, the attorney's cost instead of the client's cost?
And between the parties. That's right. Well, and also the client probably has to take off work or whatever he's doing. It's a matter of another day spent in the lawyer's office.
Further questions?
Thank you.
Tom Cooney.
I get the same thing.
Tom Cooney from Portland, appearing for myself, and also I do represent the Oregon Medical Association, which has some interest in this. First of all, I think you should realize that, like Burl said, this has been before the legislature for 22 years, ever since I started practicing law. When I went through law school, it was preached to me, I went to Willamette University, that the enlightened, God-given solution to the legal practice was that wonderful world of Oz called the Federal Rules of Procedure. And when I came out and started practicing in Portland, I practiced right between the two courts, the state, the old, archaic, unenlightened circuit court system, the code system, and right next to God's gift to mankind, the federal system. And I believed for a long time what I was taught in law school until I began to see through experience some of the fallacies that go forth in the federal system. The federal system, whenever I have a case in the federal court, part of being interrogatory, I must advise my clients on an hourly basis. I anticipate it will cost them one-third more to defend that case in that courtroom just because it's on that side of Fifth Street in Portland as opposed to over in the county courthouse. It takes that much more time. The other thing is, besides the historical defeat in the legislature for some very obvious reasons, you must bear in mind that the use of interrogatories is only valuable probably in one case out of 100. And yet, to create the situation where you really are going to give the lawyers a tool to use them in every case is absolutely foolish and unnecessary. In the federal court, the first thing that I do is get a hold of the other lawyer, the plaintiff's lawyer, and say, I'll make a deal with you. None of this federal court discovery. I won't burden your client with the expense of the interrogatories. Don't you do it to me. In other words, it's necessary to make deals to circumvent the expenses of the federal system. There's a whole system of docket requirements. The same is true with your admissions bill. You're creating a new system of objections, appearances, and rulings by the courts that are unnecessary. Remember, it's not every case that needs this type of thing. With the malpractice situation the way it is for lawyers, if you have a device or a tool such as interrogatories and you get sued in a malpractice case as a lawyer and you didn't use interrogatories, why didn't you? And you're going to become just like lawyer or doctors pretty soon. You're going to have to take preventative steps, though they may not be legally sound. You're going to have to file a request for interrogatories in order to protect yourself from a potential legal malpractice claim. The fact that the legal aid people who are on salaries are able to serve them upon people who must pay by the hour a lawyer to respond to the indigent person doesn't solve the problem from the standpoint of the person that's being sued when he has to pay it on an hourly basis. And it doesn't give you much comfort to have an award of attorney's fees because a legal aid lawyer or an indigent person abused the system when there's no way that those fees can be paid. So I think when you sit back and look at the history of the thing, that for 22 years this battle has raged among the bar, and for 22 years the legislature has seen fit not to adopt it. If you compare the effectiveness and the expense factors in the federal court versus the state court, there's little need to adopt something that we've gotten along so well without. And there's a kind of a story going around in Portland now that there's a whole change in the practice of law. And then unless the complaint that's filed has 5 counts and $1 million worth of punitive damages, it isn't a viable complaint anymore. And the second thing that's going to go along with it is they're going to be served with the 25 interrogatories. And it's a cost factor. You're going to increase the cost. It sounds super in school. It sounds super in theory that we're going to have the contest and the art of legal writing, which is what the federal court has turned into. It sounds like it's going to be a big saving, but in effect it does not. And those who practice in both systems realize that it does not. And interrogatories is one of the expensive factors. One question like, what facts do you intend to rely on in order to defend your case? Might take me 10 or 15 or 20 hours. And at $50 or $75 an hour, that's expensive. And so I strongly recommend that the committee vote this down again as the legislature has for the preceding 22 years.
Representative Kilmogowski?
Tom, would your opinion be the same if there was an exception to the bill exempting negligence cases?
No, I tell you, one of the biggest abuses is in your commercial litigation. We've just come through some of these antitrust cases in federal court, and I tell you, it's a fright. It's almost criminal. The amount of time and effort that we've had to go through, it's great for us. We get paid for it. But to have to send the bill to the client, it's bad. In my judgment, the only way that interrogatories can be justified is to put in some type of a deal where it says that in rare and exceptional cases upon application to the court, where no other reasonable means exists, then you can have a pre-submitted list of interrogatories possibly approved. But it's something that just isn't needed, and it's the way it runs in the federal court, it's a mess.
All right, Tom, in your experience, what are the maximum number of interrogatories that you've had at one time as far as the number of questions that we're asking? What's the minimum?
Boy, that's hard to answer. Because many cases you get multiple. This one antitrust case that we've got, I'll bet you there's 500.
Well, I guess what I'm trying to arrive at is the 25 question figure legitimate as far as getting to the issue?
In my judgment, it should be 3 at the maximum. Because you're going to get questions like, what facts do you intend to rely on to defend your case? That's question number one. And you're going to go from there. It's going to get worse. And so limiting it to any number. You see, it's only the one case in the 100 that you need it. And therefore, why put that tool in the hands of lawyers to run up the expenses? And we do it. I'm defending a drug company. They sent me out the big list and said, serve these on the other side. Maybe this will discourage them. I wrote back and I said, fortunately, we don't use those in the state system. And it's a weapon that people use against each other. And I'm saying, don't put that into effect when it isn't needed.
Other questions?
Thank you.
William Martin.
My name is William C. Martin. I'm Secretary of the Procedure and Practice Committee of the Oregon State Bar. I'm appearing in favor of the bill. The arguments that have been made here seem to imply that most lawyers don't know how to try cases, and given the right to use interrogatories, lawyers are going to use them no matter how much it burdens themselves, their clients, and the courts. And even though they're only useful in 1 out of 100 cases, they're going to use them in all cases. That doesn't say a great deal for either the quality or the intelligence of the bar. Most states do permit written interrogatories, and their use isn't diminishing, it's increasing. It seems to me where the greatest criticism seems to be that it is used too much hardly justifies the claim that it shouldn't be used at all. Now, if information can't be obtained in interrogatories, it has to be obtained either somewhere else or not obtained at all. It's costly to obtain information and prepare a case, particularly a large and complicated case, in any event. It seems to me that the tool of a written question, when it's limited to only 25 questions without a special order of the court, is about as simple a method as I know of. That it's subject to abuse certainly can't be denied, but that it's valuable also can't be denied. The first 5 years I practiced law, I spent the greatest share of my time in district court trying small cases. To my recollection, I never took a deposition. I think a written interrogatory would have been valuable then, and I think it would be valuable now, because it is a simple tool where the expense of a deposition is not justified, and there are a great many cases where that is true. Very few depositions can be taken without an expense of probably several hundred dollars. Maybe you could get it down to 150 in some cases, but it would be difficult. The other lawyer would have to cooperate a great deal to make sure that your time and your expense of transcriptions and everything else could justify their use in many small cases. There are cases where lawyers are not cooperating and will not give you information, and we're all aware of that. It is said that lawyers will always tell the other one, I'll give you that piece of information. I can recall a time when we spent a great deal of time on one particular case just trying to find the name of a manufacturer in the case. There are also clients who direct their attorneys, don't give anybody any information, and there are lawyers who follow those kinds of directions. To answer to a question, there are five states which have limited the number, and the average there is about 30. Kansas ties its number to the amount involved in litigation. The others just have a fixed number, such as we do. The limitation in number is tied to an abuse, which I think is common, and which I think a lot of people are speaking of, and that is the form of 400 or 500 interrogatories in one particular type of case, where even in the case that they were drafted for, may have justified that many. They may be thrown over into another case in which they will be used, where that would be somewhat burdensome. And that is the reason that we have tried to direct this to a limited number, so that you would not have that form of a whole bundle of interrogatories which were prepared for another case, which were thrown at you in a case where obviously that sort of thing would not be justified, but it didn't cost the lawyer much to prepare them because he'd prepared them before. In answer to the statement that there are can be at least 8 hearings, I suppose in any deposition with as many as 200 questions, you could have 200 hearings if everybody objected to answering every question. I never have run into that situation. I don't think you're going to run into it with this. And while there's no question, in big complicated cases, there are a lot of abuses that can come from all kinds of discovery. I do think, particularly in the smaller cases, the opportunity to ask 25 questions would be a very, very valuable tool.
Representative Gardner?
Just a couple comments and then one real quick question. It seems to me that in a very complicated case, it would be very difficult to elicit all the information that you wanted to in 25 questions. You'd probably spend more time trying to frame the questions than you'd spend in a deposition where you had an unlimited number of questions to ask. It also seems to me that in some cases, especially maybe the legal aid cases and perhaps a rather uncomplicated case, that there might be a situation where you could ask 25 questions, well thought out questions, and obviate the necessity for a deposition and the attendant cost to that. How would you feel about a situation where you could choose either to have a deposition or the 25 written interrogatories, but not both? You'd have to elect one or the other.
I think in that type of situation, you would obviously eliminate it in most of the big complicated cases, except in given situations where a few questions might give you the answer. Most people aren't going to give up the right to a deposition in any kind of a case where it's at all meaningful. So, given an alternative, it would be hard for me to conceive of very many cases where someone would choose the deposition, except in the small cases you're talking about. I think that would be true, that it would probably not get used in an awful lot of complicated cases, except in very narrow areas where you had one or two specific questions that you felt you could get a response to and couldn't do any better out of a deposition.
Mightn't that answer the questions or the problems that some of the witnesses have testified to today, that it would be used in every case?
It's conceivable that could answer some of theirs. I can't, of course, speak for anyone else, and I haven't really given a great deal of thought to limiting this in that manner. I'm sure there might be some problems I wouldn't be able to elucidate right here when you ask that question. I do think the criticisms are leveled in the complex cases. I think most people, like the gentleman from Legal Aid, who has tried cases in courts where you don't have a client with very much money and where you do want to ask a few questions, the deposition isn't the answer. And so you would opt for the interrogatories every time because it's that or nothing.
Representative Lombard, I think you were here, Mr. Martin, when Mr. Cooney expressed his concern about the broad form type of initial question. Say to a defense counsel, you know, state the facts upon which you base your defense of this action, and then expect pages of answers to laying out the whole case. Do you see any practical way, for instance, in which the types of questions or the scope of the questions could be limited?
We discussed that a great deal in the committee, and of course, some of the people who appeared here expressed the same views and the same problems, and we all agree those kind of questions are problems and long, lengthy questions. We had hoped that the 25-question limitation seem to be a reasonable answer to that type of thing, plus the attorney's fee limitations if it's an abuse. Obviously, it's not a 100% answer, and I can't tell you it's going to cure every abuse. I mean, if a bad lawyer wants to do bad things, he's going to do them. And he can do it in pleadings, and he can do it in the courtroom, and he can do it anywhere he wants to. And if he wants to do it with interrogatories, he's going to do it there, too. And I assume there are bad lawyers.
Of course, I'm wondering if you, you know, the other side of the coin is that if you reduce the number of interrogatories that can be asked, wouldn't that tend to lead to broader interrogatories in the hopes that you'd...
I don't really believe so. It would seem to me that the broad questions of interrogatories don't generally bring anything worthwhile. The questions that are worthwhile on interrogatories are when you can ask for something specific and you know the other side has that information and they're going to have to tell you. And if you're just asking a broad general question like how you're going to try your case, you're going to get a very carefully written answer by a lawyer that doesn't tell you anything. So it's kind of silly to ask those kind of questions, and I don't think they are very valuable.
Representative Butis?
What would you have most interest in the frankness with both sides have taken their case, in particular Bill? What do you have to say to the comment of Mr. Cooney that in the case of a suit against the attorney, if you don't use this device, you lay yourself open to product liability?
I just don't believe it. I believe if you try a case well, you're not laying yourself open to anything. And I don't think if it's a bad device, and if most trial lawyers say it's a bad device, as, say, Burl Green says, that you're going to have a finding that the failure to use it would mean that you would be subject to a malpractice claim.
Do you know of any cases where a judge has held the failure to use interrogatories or depositions or anything?
I've never heard of such a thing.
You still have to show it's causally related to the loss of the suit, and that just would be bad lawyering anyway.
That's right. If you did a bad investigation, whether you failed to get interrogatories or failed to talk to witnesses or failed to do what a lawyer ought to do, bad questions in a deposition, interrogatories would not be a requirement of trying a good case.
No, but I mean failure to ask them. Failure to use the interrogatory device.
Well, I could concede that as a part of an investigation where you did not conduct a good investigation for a trial, you could be guilty of malpractice, and if you didn't use, along with all your other tools, interrogatories, that would be a bad practice.
Well, as I understood Mr. Cooney, and I don't mean to put words in his mouth, I thought that's what he said.
It could be if you're not using all the tools available to you, and it's obvious if you had used them, they would have been valuable, then that would be a bad practice of law.
Representative Richards?
Did I understand the answer to your question to Representative Gardner that if it was an elective thing, either depositions or interrogatories, that you would imagine that deposition would be the choice?
In complicated cases where you had important witnesses, I doubt that many trial lawyers, as I think has already been testified to, wouldn't prefer to face the witness head on and know how he talks and what he has to say and ask him questions and see how he responds. I mean, lawyers are going to want to have that for important witnesses and certainly in important cases.
Then you do see this authorization or authority to use interrogatories as an additional step in the process?
Yes. It would certainly not substitute for depositions of important witnesses in important cases. There's no way it would do that.
Thank you.
Representative Rutherford?
Would you accept a limitation on the number of interrogatories of a lower number than 25? I'm thinking maybe even very few interrogatories.
I think I probably would personally. The committee, after going back and forth for some time, agreed upon 25. I think I might be willing to accept something less than 25. If you're asking me individually, yes. A number is hard to come by, because I think there are cases where 20 or 25 questions in a case would be very important and very succinct and worthwhile. I think more often than not, it would be a lesser number that would be valuable.
Further questions? Thank you, Mr. Martin. 2258, Laird Kirkpatrick.
Possible to make just one concluding comment in light of Mr. Rutherford's question?
Sure.
I simply wanted to state that the committee is concerned about the objections that were expressed by the opponents of the bill, and Mr. Cooney and Mr. Green expressed some very meaningful concerns that were also expressed to the committee at a number of times and to the Bar Convention generally. And as this committee can see, we did ask a law student to make a survey of all the provisions that of other states that had interrogatory provisions to see if there were any ways to limit the burdensome nature of interrogatories. And as that memorandum attached to the back of my testimony indicates, some states have experimented with excluding interrogatories from negligence cases. Some require a court order first before interrogatories. Some limit it to 50 or 25, which was the approach we ultimately adopted, but I think the committee is flexible and to try to find a middle ground is just to some way to limit the burden, but the committee decision was the limit that we placed on it. If I think in response to the question of giving litigants a choice between depositions or interrogatories, I think probably the committee preference, I can't speak for the committee, my preference would be, I think it might be preferable to have it be a provision where you're never precluded from a deposition, but you can only get interrogatories pursuant to a court order. You have to get the court order upon a showing of necessity or showing of need first. I mean, if the committee's considering that type modification, I think it might be preferable not to make an either-or choice, because when you're confronted with an either-or choice in that situation, I think you'd almost have to always go for the deposition. But I'm just giving that response, since that seems to be something that's on the committee's mind.
How many states have interrogatory practice now, do you know that?
Majority of states have some form of interrogatories, because about half the states have modeled their state procedures on the federal rules, and then other states that don't really have federal rules but have code pleading, like California, still have interrogatory provisions, so it's the majority of states, but they do have different types of limits or exclude certain types of cases from interrogatories. That memo attached to the back of my testimony is the best summary we were able to pull together. If the committee wants further research on this point, we'd be happy to try to obtain it for them, but I think it was the feeling of the committee that it is a procedure that works in most other states, in many states in an unlimited form, and it would be somewhat surprising if we couldn't find some way to make it work in Oregon, and it seems to be the opinion of a majority of the bar, two bar conventions and two committees, that it's time in Oregon to try and devise such a procedure.
Okay, go ahead.
Thank you. Sorry to delay the presentation of the next bill, which is House Bill 2258. My name is Larry Kirkpatrick. I'm chairman of the Procedure and Practice Committee of the Oregon State Bar. This bill is designed to replace the present law, which is ORS 41625. ORS 41625 presently allows a request for admission as to genuineness only of documents or physical objects. It does not allow a request for admission of truth of facts. This means that it's a very limited device for establishing authenticity of documents. Therefore, it's not possible, if there is a relatively undisputed issue such as the corporate status of the defendant or the plaintiff, to ask to have that fact admitted under current Oregon procedure. Many other states, and again the federal rules, have a procedure, it's spelled out in Federal Rule 36, for simply requesting the admission of certain facts by the opponent, and thereby establishing those facts so that they can be eliminated from the trial, and you avoid trying issues that are truly uncontested. If you don't have this type of procedure, often it's necessary to pursue these matters in depositions or other types of discovery devices, or to try issues of trial that are essentially undisputed. So the procedure adopted here would simply allow a party to file a request for admission that would cover not only genuineness of documents, but expand it to truth of certain relevant facts in the lawsuit, and seek out those admissions. If the admissions are not, if the matter is not admitted and it's necessary for the party to prove that fact at trial, and the trial judge decides that there was no reasonable ground to contest that issue of fact, there was no basis for contesting the fact that was requested to be admitted, then the party that required the moving party to put on that evidence can be forced to pay the cost of having that proof put on. So it's a relatively simple device. It is modeled after Federal Rule 36, provides the sanctions provided in Rule 37C, and is designed to replace ORS 41.625.
Does this depart in any significant way from Rule 36?
I wouldn't say in any significant way. It's slightly more narrow in the sense that the attorney's fee sanction uses the word may instead of shall, and it doesn't contain the rule in the provision in Rule 36 about requesting opinions of fact or the application of law to fact. This statute is limited to requesting admissions of relevant facts, and it doesn't reach to requests for opinions of fact or the application of law to fact the way Rule 36 does.
Questions? Mike King.
Thank you, Mike. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Mike King. I practice in Portland. I'm a member of the Procedure and Practice Committee. I'm here in that capacity today to speak in favor of the bill. Just to supplement what Laird had to say, I do practice in federal court and have quite a bit in recent years. And I think the request for admissions is much less used and much less abused than the interrogatories. And I think that this should be considered separately, and that's one of the reasons the bar presented it in this manner this year. The request for admissions is not generally used until sometime later in the proceeding. It has two effects as far as I'm concerned. It can cut down discovery because you can ask for an admission on a fact during the course of discovery. And if that fact is admitted, there's no need for further discovery on it. It can cut down on the issues at the time of trial, because if you have an admitted fact, there's no need to present evidence on it. We can do this in state court today by stipulation between attorneys, and sometimes attorneys can reach stipulation. But many attorneys won't stipulate to anything. So a request for admission makes them take a look at just what they've got early on. And they know that if they don't admit the fact, and if they've got nothing to dispute it with, then they can pay the cost of your proving that fact. I think requests for admissions would not be used very often, that if you got a request for admission, it's generally only one, two, possibly three requests. It presents no burden to the attorney receiving the request if it's not a proper request. In other words, if it's a frivolous request for admission, all the attorney who receives it has to do is write down denied, and it goes back. And so I think from that standpoint, it's not something that's going to involve a great deal of work for the party receiving it. It's a useful tool if, in fact, there's no issue on a given point, because you know that in advance of trial, and you can save time both on discovery and at the time of trial. Any questions?
Thank you, Mayor. Representative Fromer.
Yes, sir, this may be a question for you or for Professor Kirkpatrick or whomever wants to answer it. That is that the federal rule that deals with requests for admissions talks about admissions with respect to matters, whereas this one talks about requests with respect to facts. Is there a reason why the difference in language?
I wasn't on the committee when the bill, this is my first year on the committee, I wasn't on the committee when the bill was prepared. I talked briefly with Laird about it before, and he indicated that the only thing this was intended to recover is the truth of facts. And it goes on to recodify the ORS 41625 on genuineness of document and physical objects. But I don't know why the reason the term matters wasn't put in there.
Laird, can you comment on that?
That matter wasn't considered by the committee. The language is just taken directly from Section 4 of House Bill 3013 from the last session.
I guess I can't think of anything that's not a fact that isn't also a matter, but the reverse might not hold true. And in any event, if it's the purpose of the committee to get language that allows us then to rely on federal precedent, so we only have to keep appealing, I wonder whether or not you could either come up with a definitive explanation as to why the difference, or whether we shouldn't consider tracking the federal rule completely if we presume to adopt it.
The federal rule itself ties back into 26B at that point. It speaks of matters
within the scope of Rule 26B, which is the rule defining scope of discovery and which corresponds to, in part, Section... Well, it's in the other two bills. It isn't in this one. It's Section 3 of 2250... Section 4 of 2257. But anyway, it ties back into the general statement of the scope of discovery. Well, was that a... That wasn't a matter which the committee... which the committee deliberately made an exclusive kind of choice, or...
That wasn't even discussed by the committee. I think but the reason why we didn't use the language of the federal rule is because the scope of discovery provision we have there in this legislation is more narrow than 26, federal rule 26, and we couldn't incorporate the exact language of the federal rule because the discovery, the scope of discovery provision of these bills aren't as broad as all of federal rule 26.
Yeah. Well, if we were going to language like that, we'd have to tie it into our own. We might have to incorporate that section in this bill and then tie it into section such and such of this act. Further questions? Thank you, Mike. Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Dugas?
Can I ask you to give me an illustration of how this would work?
Well, let me give you
a hypothetical.
Yeah, simple illustration in the ordinary auto accident case, well, not ordinary, auto accident case, where you have a family purpose situation where I can think of one recently where we took the deposition. I'll give you a different example. An employment situation where you allege that an individual was acting in the course and scope of his employment at the time the accident occurred. I took a deposition recently, and the employer testified that he had left the job, was driving his truck, and had made a stop that was within the course of his employment and went on, and the accident happened. I've asked the other attorney several times to tell me whether they're going to contest scope of employment at the time of trial, and he's indicated that he can't tell me. A request for admission would just say, admit that X was in the scope of his employment at the time of the accident. If he denies that, and you have to bring in witnesses to testify to that, then the court can require the person who denied it to pay the cost of these witnesses. But I think that if you had the request for admissions, he'd have to take a long look at it before he denied it, and you'd probably get an admission.
Thank you.
Okay.
Further questions? Thank you, Mike. John Baker.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is John Baker, representing the Workman's Compensation Board. The administrative hearings conducted by the Workman's Compensation Board and some of the other agencies for that matter often involve unrepresented litigants. And the board is concerned that the language of this bill, after commencement of an action suit or proceeding, that the word proceeding might be broadly interpreted to include administrative hearings, and the board would urge that clarifying language be added as an amendment to the bill. Particularly the silence as admission would be probably unconscionable as applied to unrepresented people appearing as parties in these proceedings.
I had intended to ask a question about that also in connection with 2257. It just slipped by me. Laird, could you come back up for a little bit? The reference to or proceeding appears in, well, I think it's in all three bills, actually. Also in 2259. And I think you and I chatted a little bit about this particular question, too. The reference or proceeding, is there any explanation of its meaning in terms of what the committee intended by its inclusion?
This is a matter that wasn't discussed by the committee. Again, the committee used the language of House Bill 3013 from the last session as the model, which contained that language, action suit or proceeding, in it. The existing deposition statute does use the language special proceeding as far as taking depositions, and when I just talked to Mr. Baker before this hearing, I looked at the 41625, and that uses the word proceeding too. And so I agree he has an interesting point, and it's a problem. It's an ambiguity, though, that's in the existing law. And if we're changing the law, we might as well clarify the ambiguity. But the word proceeding is used both in the existing deposition statute and the existing motion to admit genuineness statute. So the problem of its applicability against an unrepresented party probably should be dealt with, but that is a problem with current law.
The reason, of course, that the board is more concerned with this bill than it was with the existing law that is that this bill makes silence an admission of fact. The existing law didn't do that.
Do we have this vehicle in any administrative proceedings in Oregon? We don't, do it.
Those are spelled out in Chapter 183, to the extent that they're granted at all, I believe. Yeah.
Do agencies have authority under 183 to promulgate additional vehicles for discovery data?
I'd take the position that they do.
And I believe the board takes that position, too, that whatever will expedite the proceedings under its jurisdiction can be promulgated through the administrative rulemaking process.
Representative Rutherford?
If you took the word proceeding out, what would you do with a writ of review and a mandamus, as an example?
Well, I possibly would suggest inserting the word court before the four words action suit or proceeding, rather than simply delete proceeding, or to go further and add explicit exclusionary language that the act shall not apply to administrative proceedings. It wouldn't be enough, of course, to say the act would not apply to proceedings under 183 because there are large classes of administrative proceedings which are not under 183.
Well, I can see certain advantages to administrative hearings, actually, some contested cases providing for this degree of discovery might considerably expedite the administrative proceedings, so I'm not sure that in all cases it would be advantageous to exclude it.
The board's concern was with the unrepresented.
I understand. I think the case is well made.
Of course, you'd have to initiate that request, though, wouldn't you, for the admissions before that would come into play?
Yes, but the other side could ask the unrepresented person to admit every fact possible or conceivable, and if the person didn't respond, didn't know what was going on, there goes his case.
Representative Romer.
What would you think of a provision that simply said that this did not apply in the case of any party not represented by counsel?
I think that would
deal with it generically rather than by.
I think that that would answer the primary concern, which is the unrepresented person. It would not, of course, take care of the position that the agencies have rulemaking power to adopt the procedures which would expedite their particular hearings.
Just so I'm clear, it was not the committee's intention, as I understand it, Laird, to deal with administrative proceedings with these bills, was it?
That issue just was never discussed at a committee hearing. I would say that I don't think it was the intention of the committee, but I really can't speak for the committee because that issue was never.
I'm not speaking against extending it, I just wanted to be sure that.
No. All the discussion we had was in terms of judicial proceedings.
Question, Mr. Chairman?
Isn't it an appealable error if the man is mistreated in the administrative hearing? Let's say he doesn't have counsel and they do something like this. Jeopardize his rights and infringe on his rights.
It might very well be, but of course that would be additional delay in the resolution of this case and additional expense.
Further questions? Thank you. Tom Cooney.
Show you how progress occurs. Mike King and I were partners for many years, and I thought I had him completely convinced that federal rules were all bad, and here he's in favor of this.
He's been winning a lot more in federal court.
Right. I have a couple of concerns about the demand for admissions. The first is you're encountering the same situation where you're creating a new system of filings, of hearings, of objections, more hearings, more sanctions of attorney's fees, and even having to put on proof or evidence as to the reasonableness of the attorney's fees. So the demand for admissions is another step in the chink of procedures that we're putting in to make it more expensive to work in court. It does another thing that has been a trap in the federal court, which is supposed to be noted for its freedom of traps, but the most apparent one is on line 14, where if you don't answer within the 30 days, it's automatically admitted. And this, I think, is a real problem. And I would suggest that you, if you're going to adopt the admission, that you give serious consideration to some type of a notification system so that you don't have someone serving a demand for a series of admissions which would admit a person out of court and through an oversight of some way that the 30-day time schedule runs on him and therefore he is precluded and automatically has admitted himself out of court. This is a very bad aspect of the particular bill.
Now, are you suggesting that the, if I understand, that the request when served would have to include notification of the effect of failure to answer?
No, I'm thinking there's something along the lines that if they are not answered within the 30-day period, the requesting party can make application to have them deemed admitted, something of that sort. But there's been this problem in the federal system. You get interrogatories and admissions sometimes intermingled. And the interrogatories, you're not faced with this 30-day time limit and the automatic consequence of admission. And so you think, well, I have 30 days and Joe won't worry about it if I get it to him in a reasonable time. The 30-day limitation on your admissions, if you don't have it in 30 days or you don't have some type of stipulated form, it's deemed admitted. And so you're really putting the lawyer on either side of that it may be and under the gun on that 30-day limitation. And I'm just saying that in order to avoid that trap, that time trap, if we're going to use the admissions, make something in there which triggers the person to make him realize that, hey, the time has run, and now all these lists of things that they've asked you to admit are, for the matter of the case, now in fact admitted. And I think that's just a safeguard so that you don't have a time running on people without them realizing it. And it's particularly true, like you say, with the unrepresented or the people that aren't that familiar with it. The other thing you're going to find is when you set this into effect, every time you change the procedure, you change the practice of law for practicing lawyers, and there's going to be a 6 or 8 month or a year period for lawyers to realize, hey, if I don't answer those darn things in 30 days, they're admitted. And so this would be a safeguard to prevent that. The other portion of the bill that gives me concern is on page 2, starting on line 29. An answering party may not give lack of information or knowledge as a reason for failure to admit or deny unless the information known or readily obtainable by him is insufficient to enable him to admit or deny. A party who considers that a matter of which an admission has been requested presents a genuine issue for trial may not, on that ground alone, object to the request. This is a little severe as to what you may or may not admit. Then you get into the matter of attorney's fees. Why not, from one side or the other, make a demand for admissions in every case if it's a rear-end accident where the liability is probable, but you probably don't want to admit it? Why doesn't the plaintiff's lawyer make a demand for a series of admissions and then take a chance on not only winning the case, but having attorney's fees thereafter? And the matter of sanctions kind of smacks a little bit of the federal court is full now of this business of you bad little boys are going to stay after school and write on the blackboard, I will no longer sin because it's such and such. And this is what's creeping into this type of system here. The demand for admissions is not as burdensome a problem to us as the interrogatories are. But I point out this time trap and this limitation on the reasons for denial. And I think perhaps the matter of assessing attorney's fees for anything other than a bad faith denial, frequently in major litigation, I may not know in 30 days whether I want to admit that fact or not because the chain of events hasn't fallen together. And if I have to admit or deny, if I deny it and later on want to admit it, they say, looky here, your client's a liar. He denied it, now he's admitting it. It can be used against you. The right to admit is always available to us now in the code system when you file the answer. You can admit or deny whatever you want to admit or deny. The other side knows immediately when your answer is filed than what they must prove. And it's not that difficult to get it on deposition or a motion to request for production of records. So this may not be something you need from an expense standpoint as well.
Questions? Mr. Lombard.
Tom, it seems to me, though, that the real saving or time and cost saving that you're addressing in this situation is whether or not you're going to have to put on proof at the time of trial. Isn't that so?
Oh, yes, that's true.
And in the case of admissions, and the same as we have with stipulations today, there actually would be a saving to litigants for those matters that are admitted and you don't have to put the proof on, wouldn't there?
Yes. If you have the lawyers that won't ever talk to each other, for those fellows. But here's what I'm concerned about. When I'm seeing the practice change, we've grown from 1,500 lawyers to 5,000 lawyers. What I'm talking about is a real legitimate problem. The complaint that has the 5 counts for this and $1 million worth of punitive damages, it's happening. When you put the attorney's fees sanction in here, why isn't it just as good and just as smart and just as good a practice to put on the demands for admissions and then hit them with the demand for attorney's fees afterwards as part of every case? And what you're doing is creating a tool that can be used to, again, bump up the cost. Yes, demands for admissions can serve a good purpose. We do it now by, good practicing lawyers do it by, you call me up and say, sure, I'll agree to that.
Just in some counties we have.
Yes, I remember that. We all.
Let me ask you this. I don't know, to my knowledge, that this has been suggested or put in the statutes before, but would there be any value in limiting the time or setting a time frame within which you could demand admissions?
Yeah.
In other words, you see here that actually anytime 20 days after the service is summoned, you can start filing demands for admissions.
Right.
What if you were to turn that around and say that within 20 days or 30 days of the date of trial or date set for trial, anytime within that period you could file a demand for admission?
I think that makes more sense. Now, the opposite, taking the devil's advocate position, though, they're going to say, well, why not do it early and save the expense of discovery? But I think your approach that closer in time, if the person is having trouble, make such a demand. That'd be fine. I again would prefer to see these things not be available as a matter of right. I would prefer to see it be upon application to the court that such information is not available, that they be given under certain circumstances the right to submit the demand for admission, which the court will require the answer. Because the carte blanche demand for admissions with the potential of catching attorney's fees on it is a very good way of trying to protect your client's interests by recovering attorney's fees.
What would the standard be, though, Tom, if the court would apply in determining whether or not to permit requests?
The problem of giving
it isn't that the information isn't available, it's that it's unnecessary to adduce all of it by way of testimony to prove something that's really not in dispute.
I don't know that I can give you a criterion, because I think that's the problem with anything that we try and restrict, because I'm sure there's going to be cases where we could fall outside the criterion. I just am fearful of open-ended use of this type of procedure when you can recover attorney's fees on the end of it, and you're going to be again clogging up your courtroom with objections to demands for admissions, objections to answers, applications for attorney's fees, more court time. And the incredible thing about it is, I've practiced law 22 years, and I've never seen a case where the other side had any difficulty in failing because they couldn't prove something that was obtainable. I really have. And maybe other people have had that experience, but I just wonder how critical it is when you put your cost factor to it.
The point about not being obtainable, though, that seems to relate quite as directly to this kind of device as it might to some others, like an interrogatory.
Perhaps I lost the train of your question. I probably wasn't responding.
That's it.
Okay.
Representative Rutherford.
If you were the defendant in a rear-ender and I was the plaintiff, and I sent you a request for admission, which said as follows, will you admit or deny liability? Is that the kind of fact that is contemplated under this statute?
Well, I don't know. I like to think that when they chose the word facts, that they did so for the express purpose of excluding pure opinion or mixed fact and legal judgment. I can envision a horrendous use of these in medical malpractice cases. Is your conduct in accordance with the standard of practice of reasonable practitioners in the community? Admit or deny? The demand for attorney's fees immediately. Did your negligence cause the death of the, you know, do you admit that? And if you lose, then you've got a claim for attorney's fees in there. I would think that demands for admissions must of themselves relate to facts only. Because if you start getting opinions in there, then you're, no one's going to admit to opinions.
Or you say limited to facts. I know that lawyers have for a long time had a difficult time deciding what facts are.
Right.
You mean physical facts, things that could be judicially noticed? What kinds of things?
No, I would think, did you stop at the stop sign? Did you see my client's car before the collision? I think those are express facts which might fall within the scope of your demand for admissions. Now, were you negligent? I think is the mixture that probably would be an improper inquiry, but maybe not.
Well, like I said, from my experience in federal court, I can't imagine a federal judge regarding that as a proper request for admission.
Oh, the only
is denied, and if the case is later lost by the denying party, that the party would be subjected to attorney's fees.
I don't doubt that, but the point is, you're going to get them, and you're going to end up going to court, you're going to go up objecting to them, and you're, again, time consuming.
Well, just deny it.
It just seems as a comment that what we're talking about is evidentiary versus ultimate facts.
Yes.
The request for admission for evidentiary facts would be proper, whereas one for ultimate facts.
Yes, but I don't think it's that clear from the language of the bill. So I think that the biggest concern is and I have fought it sometimes in the federal court where I'll get the mixture of interrogatories and admissions, and geez, that admission will be in there, and that 30 days will run, and it'll hit me that, by golly, that's admitted, now I'm dead in the water. And so I would think that something along the lines of making application that they be deemed admitted, some notice be given to trigger that situation so the lawyer doesn't get trapped in that situation.
Other questions?
Is it kind of your statement or your position that this is just kind of an additional statutory tool to supplement the procedure of stipulation, and it's really not necessary?
That's my feeling. Now, there are lawyers, as Mike mentions, that will not agree to anything. I know that. But I really can't say that there's been any case that I've been aware of where the lawyer on the other side failed in his cause because he couldn't get a particular thing. It might have been a little more difficult. But as I say, this is not as oppressive or as creates such a burden as the interrogatories does, but you do set up a whole other system of run the court, object, file, do this type of thing. And right now, we've been functioning for a long time without it. As I say, when you file your answer, the other side knows immediately what they have to prove. I would prefer to see some system of application to the court for the demand for admission so that it isn't a carte blanche, open-ended thing that we can do just at the drop of a hat.
What was your position, though, before it leaves, Mr. Chairman, what was your position on the 30-day service thing? Because it looks to me like the language is fairly clear, and it seems to me at this...
It's an automatic, if your answer isn't filed, it's an automatic admission.
Right. But you do have to get served under this.
Oh, yes. But what I'm getting at is there's so many things that we have that go on
that there are deadlines, that we know there is going to be no problem about meeting the deadline, either through an understanding that the other lawyer is going to cooperate or what. But this one automatically is an admission.
But it seems if this is going to work as a real adjunct to stipulations, you'd have to put kind of a forced time period.
I don't object to that. I'm just saying that before it becomes a binding admission in court, give the lawyer some notice that the plaintiff or the, whoever's making the request for admission is going to ask the court, kind of like a notice of default, that you're going to ask the court in 5 days that these be deemed admitted. And just as a reminder so that you, in fact, really are admitting what you intend to admit, because what you're admitting is your client's rights.
So you want on the part of the requesting attorney a reminder?
A reminder.
Okay.
Because the lawyer can let it lapse, and that can work to the detriment of his client.
Thank you. Mr. Martin?
I'm Steve Martin. I'm speaking on behalf of the Oregon State Bar, and I'll be very brief. I would like to speak to the matter that Tom spoke of about the problem of the 30-day automatic admission. The Federal Rule 36 does contain a provision: any matter admitted under this rule is conclusively established unless the court on motion permits withdrawal or amendment of the admission. I personally think that would be a good addition to this rule. It does not contain, I mean, to this act. And it is not contained in that. His contentions are justified in this regard. As the other matters, I think there's been enough testimony from the Oregon State Bar, and I won't testify further unless somebody has some questions.
One question.
Go ahead. Representative Gardner.
Witcher, have you practiced much in federal court?
Yes, I'm much more in state court than I have in federal court. But I have practiced in federal court, yes.
What's your experience with the court allowing withdrawal of the admission after
the... I don't think it's run into all the possible difficulty that has been talked about. I've never heard of anyone getting anywhere in federal court with you admit that you are liable, and if you don't, we're going to charge you attorney's fees, that sort of thing. I don't think federal court would give that very...
No, I think it's question.
That's not my question. My question is, in those instances where the 30 days has run,
oh,
and a fact has been admitted,
I can't tell you. I'm not aware of any of those instances coming up or any problems arising in that kind of situation. So I can't tell you.
Further questions?
Yes.
Representative Fulmer.
The citation to the federal provision for amendment or whatever you made reference to, and I didn't catch it.
Yes, that's subsection
B.
Of Rule 36.
Thank you.
Not all of subsection B, but that's the part I felt.
Further questions? Thank you, Mr. Martin. We'll take a 10-minute recess and then return to complete the testimony of the two bills. Would like the members to please be back at exactly the quarter till... because we also have some committee bills to consider today for introduction by the 5 o'clock deadline. I want to finish these two bills today since we have witnesses who come down to be here for that purpose.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to be able to finish a few minutes before 5. I have some of my own bills that I just have to introduce today.
I think the next two bills hopefully will not take as long. We have only a couple of witnesses signed up on, I take that back, 59.
Mr. Chairman, I miswrote my name on the next two bills that I did not attend, so I will withdraw.
Okay. I'm sure the other witnesses will be brief and non-repetitive. 10-minute recess. We will come to order. House Bill 2259. Mr. King.
Thank you.
Larry, if you want to come up also, I see you're signing to the bar. If you two want to go through together, that's fine.
I'm representing the Oregon State Bar and member of the Procedure and Practice Committee on this bill. This bill, I don't think, is quite as controversial as the two you've just had. Primarily, it eliminates the court order part of production of documents. Under the present Oregon law, in order to obtain production of documents, testing and so forth, the procedure is to file a motion, have a hearing, and then the court enters an order. Now, the primary purpose of this bill is to bring it in line with the changes to the federal rule so so that the first step in obtaining production of documents is to file a request for production, which is sent to the attorney. The attorney then responds to that request, and only if the request is refused, then you go to court with a motion to require production. There are other, if you will, changes or additions to the statute. I'll go through these section by section very quickly. Under Section 2, other than changing it from a motion to a request, the only new language in there is to test or sample any tangible things. Section 4 appears to me to codify the decision in Southern Pacific versus Bryson, which would allow a party to obtain documents or things which were prepared in anticipation of litigation for trial or for another party, but only upon a showing that the party seeking the request has substantial need of the materials and that he is unable without undue hardship to obtain the substantial equivalent of the materials by other means. Again, I'll point out that I was not on the committee at the time this bill was prepared, but it's my belief that this attempts to codify the decision of the Supreme Court in Southern Pacific versus Bryson, which says much the same thing. The next item that I felt was of some importance to the committee, of course, is the Section 3, Sub 2A. Again, if a party refuses to produce documents, allow inspection, allow access, and then there is a motion filed and the moving party prevails, then the court can require the other side to pay the costs, and if the motion is denied, can also require the moving party to pay the cost. Subsection 3 of Section 3 provides for sanctions, which are the same sanctions as presently set out in ORS 41.615 if you fail to obey the court's order to produce. Section 4 allows for a protective order. When you receive a request for production, you can move for a protective order. And we don't have a protective order in Oregon, apparently, except for depositions. But I know that the courts do grant protective orders in circuit court. I guess they feel they have jurisdiction to do that type of thing. So as a practical matter, it is being done at this time, but this would give the statutory authority to proceed for a protective order. Section 5 relates to the scope of discovery, previously mentioned by Kirkpatrick in testimony on the other bill. And this, again, is a direct quote from Federal Rule 26B1. Again, I think it's a good idea to set out what matters may be discovered. Section 6 on, is just a change in reference to statute numbers. Wherever it previously referred to Section 45181, it now refers to this particular amendment. Sum it up, it seems to me that this is just a procedural change which eliminates the original step of going to court to get an order to produce. It gives some clarification to what you can produce. It also allows you to obtain evidence which, while it may not be relevant, might lead to the discovery of other relevant evidence. Again, I check the annotations. It's been my experience in state court that the judge does allow you to obtain evidence while not relevant to the particular matter if it will lead to the discovery of relevant evidence. That's in the federal rules, but has not been in the Oregon Code. But I assume that the courts have been liberal in allowing discovery under the statute and have allowed that type of discovery. Basically, I don't think there are any real substantive changes in this statute. It's primarily procedural and codification of what is existing practice.
Just to clarify one thing for the committee's record, what you've described as the codification of Southern Pacific is, of course, to be distinguished from the whole area of attorney work product.
That's correct.
And Bryson, that case involved, railroad investigators' reports?
Yes, investigators' reports made by the railroad prior to the filing of the litigation, as I remember. I copied the case and brought it with me. In fact, I can leave it with you if you'd like it.
Where do we stand on the statement of protection for the Hickman v. Taylor kind of situation? Is that elsewhere in the code now, or is that simply judge-made law in Oregon? I can't remember.
I don't know.
We don't have any statutory provision other than this. Well, Section 4 actually deals with the Hickman versus Taylor situation as the first part of the federal rule in Federal Rule 26. It just doesn't go all the way through 26, but that comes from 26 B3, trial preparation, the middle part of that paragraph of Federal Rule 26 B3, and it may be that it would be desirable to go on and incorporate the full federal rule on that.
Does ORS speak to the issue of attorney work product in the code right now?
No, it does not.
Seems to me that's important.
The committee, I appreciate that in 26B you also get into the matter of discoverability of insurance, which is a separate subsection. And let's just throw that out for a minute. Did the committee consider, from your experience in the committee, was there any adverse view taken with respect to the description of the protection for trial preparation materials which are contained in Rule 26?
That is
one way of stating the protection, and I wondered if you had any comment on the appropriateness of that language as a statement of that protection.
It seems to me to codify that issue might save some litigation. I mean, that issue is being tested, it seems to me, now in a number of trial court cases, in some cases reaching the Supreme Court, and the Oregon law is very, very uncertain in that area. And rather than having it resolved through case law, it might be desirable to simply make it adopt the federal provisions regarding it, or just make some provision by statute to head off the continued relitigation of that issue in the state court.
Do either of you have any comment on the way Rule 26 purports to codify, so to speak, the rules or rule involved?
You're speaking of subsection 3, last sentence of.
It's
in ordering to
trial prep. It's sub. Yeah, sub 3.
There's a sentence. It reads, in ordering discovery of such materials, when the required showing has been made, the court shall protect against disclosure of the mental impressions, conclusions, opinions, or legal theories of an attorney or other representative of a party concerning the litigation. Is this what you were referring to?
Well, I was referring to all of sub 3, trial preparation materials, and then there's a sub 4, I guess, trial preparation experts.
Every time we get into a request for production. And this occurs in federal court. The federal court cases aren't all that clear on what is work product and what is privilege. You run into the question of distinction of privilege and work product on occasion, too. I think it would be well to try and codify this in some fashion so we know where we are. But I think it would take a fair amount of work to really sit down and try and do it. I'm not sure exactly what you're after, Hardy, but I just think we'd be hard-pressed at this time to try and give you something to further define work product.
Representative Grant?
I think that's an area that's probably best left to further judicial interpretation, because it's kind of a non-exhaustive area. You can always think of one more thing that would have to be litigated one way or the other, whether it is work product or not.
It may be. I always think that it would be nice to have everything in the code so that there would be no question, so you can decide something, but it's not possible.
The section that is in here, subsection 4 of section 2 of the bill, I think is just consistent with case law, as Mike indicates, and I think even if we were to incorporate more of the trial preparation section, I don't think that's too much of a deviation from existing Oregon case law, but to jump over to section 4 on trial preparation, I think that might lead to more of an adverse reaction of having to give a summary of your witness's statements on those provisions of the federal rule, I think would receive a more adverse reaction from the bar than attempting to codify the work product document.
Did the committee omit that last sentence in 3 in ordering discovery when the required showing has been made, the court shall protect against the disclosure of the mental impressions, conclusions, opinions, or legal theories? Was that left out of the... Let me start over. Section 2, sub 4, in a sense, is a summary statement of the first part of the trial preparation materials portion of Rule 26. That last sentence is not included.
That issue is not discussed, and so there is no intent to leave it out. The reason for it being left out was, again, the committee was attempting to conform its model to House Bill 3013. In fact, basically the way the resolution was adopted in the committee was to approve 3013, except to break it down into 3 separate bills. So once 3013 was approved by the committee for resubmission to the bar and using that as the base, then it was just a matter of breaking it into different bills, and that language was not included in 3013.
I can't imagine that any attorney would want to include that in the matters that could be discovered, mental impressions, legal conclusions.
No, I would say I'm putting in an express prohibition against
it. Yes.
Directive, protection, protective directive, such as appears here. Questions? Senator Frommeyer?
This is a quick one, and I know it could take an exhaustive answer, but please just tell me yes or no. Are you convinced that the deletion of the good cause requirement is well-founded? And I know there's a long history of litigation under the federal rules.
It would be under Section 2.4.
Right.
It's not deleted by the federal rules, David.
Yes, I understand it's deleted by the federal rules, and I've had no experience with the federal rules since it was deleted. Is that experience favorable enough that we should follow the federal track?
I can't think of any thing that's come up in my experience where it's been any problem. I think the showing of substantial need of the materials is unable without undue hardship is inclusive enough of the problems that the plaintiff would have to show.
Another question, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
Yeah. The federal rule uses the language of designated documents, whereas this language doesn't refer to specifically to asking for designated documents. What's the reason for Oregon going a different route than the federal rule here?
You're asking me a question I don't know. I wasn't involved in any discussion.
Flared on that.
I'm sorry. The first paragraph, or section 2A, makes a reference to designated documents, but you mean why isn't the language incorporated that defines designated
mm-hmm.
documents
yeah.
in the federal rule? Again, simply because 3013 was used as the model, which did not include that definition, which seems perhaps just because of the way it read, it was somewhat long and cumbersome, but it may be desirable to have that definition in there to make the federal case law more valuable for interpretive purposes. But the committee didn't consider that issue expressly and simply used 3013 as the model, which did not have that language included.
Final question, Mr. Larry, have you received a copy of the letter that Professor Lacey wrote me?
Yes, I have.
No question about it, except that do you plan either to respond to that or to submit proposed amendments that might incorporate those changes insofar as you agree with them?
Not really, in the sense that his suggestions, I don't know if the rest of the members of the committee have a copy of that letter. One of his comments goes to the fact that the definition of the scope of discovery, first of all, incorporates the old federal rule. Well, that's not quite accurate in the language in this bill is taken from the current federal rule, B1, The question is, should we go beyond that and include things in B2 and B3, like insurance agreements? And the committee felt it would just be desirable to take it one step at a time. It might just be too controversial to get by the bar to incorporate the whole Federal Rule 26. So the committee did consciously decide to limit it simply to the first step, as to whether, you know, the bar would oppose, the committee would oppose expansion of that, I don't know. But it was a conscious decision to limit it to simply
26B1. Okay, thank
you.
Further questions?
Mr. Chairman, if I can make just one comment on it, there is a typo in that statute. I should call to the committee's attention that does, I think, have an effect on the substance. And that is on page 2, line 24, it's simply a comma, but that comma should be moved from after the 2 down to the other end of the sentence after objection, unless the request is objected to with the statement of reasons for each objection, comma, within 30 days after the service of the request. I think that would change the meaning of that time period, so I think that's the appropriate place for that comma.
Okay, that's noted.
Thank you.
22-60.
Chairman, my name is Larry Fitzpatrick. For the record, I'm representing the Oregon State Bar. This is probably the simplest bill of the entire package. It would simply make a very minor amendment to ORS 18080 and eliminate the right to jury trial upon a default case. The situation arises relatively infrequently, but the complaint was brought to our committee a year or two ago involving a case in Eugene where a plaintiff had obtained a default judgment against the defendant, and the defendant exercised the right under the statute as currently worded to demand a jury trial on the issue of damages and had a week-long jury trial. It was the position of the plaintiff's attorney that since the defendant had defaulted, that it was really unnecessary and inappropriate to allow a defaulting defendant to come in and have a jury trial on the issue of damages, that if there was a legitimate issue as to damages, that could be raised by an answer, and that therefore the right to a jury trial in a default case should be deleted from the statute, and that's the purpose of this proposed statute.
Questions? Representative Bugis? Other than a violation of procedure, what's wrong with that? I realize the defense sensibilities and attorneys, but why not go to the jury with damages in certain cases?
Perhaps there's not a problem. I think the thought is that a defaulting defendant is in essence admitting all allegations of the complaint, including allegations as to damages. So if you do not appear within the time allowed, you are conceding everything the plaintiff has alleged, and that is traditionally what's meant by a default, and that therefore you should suffer the consequences. And if you do have a contest, as
you should suffer the consequences of a judge making the damages.
Well, that's true. Maybe that isn't intended to be one of the consequences, and that there is a legitimate question about that. I don't think there's a strong feeling on the bar. This really happens relatively rarely. And,
yeah, it is unusual, but I was just curious.
And
I've neither heard of the occasion happening, but nor the objection. I don't have strong feelings. I never even realized you could do that, as a matter of fact.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Lombard?
It's not the situation where the plaintiff may be seeking punitive damages and there is a default. Would it be good public policy in that situation to leave that entirely in the hands of the court?
Well, that is the question, I suppose, as to whether the defendant is certainly it's traditional that a defendant can waive a right to jury trial any time by any number of ways. And I think the feeling of the plaintiff's attorneys and of the attorneys that voted for this proposal was that is a waiver. To allow a default judgment to be entered against your client is a waiver of various rights, including the right to a jury trial, and that should be the rule. But certainly,
an argument could be made that you should not interpret a default as waiving the right to jury trial on damages, but a more traditional way of obtaining the trial on the damages issue, if that is the defendant's position, is to file an answer admitting liability but denying the damages allegation and go to trial on that basis and not have it treated as a default case. But I don't think there's strong feeling about this among the members of the bar simply because it arises so rarely.
Other questions?
Just one more, Mr. Chairman. It's not really a question, but isn't a default quite generally is a case where there's dereliction or sloppiness on behalf of the attorney? And it strikes me that there may be a way to salvage a little something for the client here. And I hate to take it away from him if indeed the attorney wakes up in time to maybe salvage something by letting it go to jury. That's the only motivation I
have. You're suggesting a default case where malpractice may have been committed. This is a way to mitigate the damages by at least getting a jury trial on the damages question. That's a possible consideration. Seems to me the real problem with this statute is one that even goes beyond this particular problem, and that is that the statute allows judgments in contract cases to be entered upon application by the plaintiff filed with the clerk without any assessment or any review even by a judge. In the first part of the statute, our committee has not dealt with that yet, although we may be dealing with that in future years. But that is an even more serious problem, arguably, under this statute. But if it's a contract case, even for unliquidated damages, the clerk can enter the judgment. So if the committee is going to make a major revision, it might want to consider that additional problem that is not the basis of any bar recommendation at this time, but the bar is focusing purely on the jury trial.
Further questions? Thank you both.
Thank you.
We have time for both presentations.
Before we decide how to vote on the measure.
Not unless he brings it out directly.
Gardner's not very guarded in the end stuff.
No,
Review quickly some of the bills we have. I'll hold Mr. Wilson's bill for a moment. And I want to also mention the Lifers Club does want us to come out, and I would like to see where we adjourn. No. I would like to try to work out a date. I've got a couple of requested dates, and I'd like to see what the committee's pleasure is. The Lifers Club at OSP.
I can ask you about sometimes those of us who have not made a tour of the correctional facilities. Maybe I'm the only one. I don't know.
I've only been to OSP. I'd like to go to the others.
I intend that the committee will be doing that. LP 1990 provides that defendant in rape prosecution must prove by a preponderance of the evidence that evidence of previous sexual conduct of complainant is relevant, provides for hearing to be held out of presence of public and jury to determine the question of admissibility, provides instances in which evidence of previous sexual conduct of the complainant will be relevant. This bill is intended to try to correct the problems noted in the recent case out of Multnomah County, in which portions of the statute we passed last session were held unconstitutional. Second,
who requested that to be drafted, Mr. Chairman?
Well, I think it's an amalgam of the ACLU and a number of interested attorneys and the Women's Political Caucus and so forth. I don't have a specific requesting party. It would be shown as a committee bill.
Can we set that one aside? I'd like to look at it.
The next one is coming from the Speaker's office. LP 2055 allows court to award reasonable attorney's fee to prevailing party in suitor action unless an award of attorney's fee for the suitor action is specifically disallowed by law. That's a bill we had last session, which was tabled in committee. Speaker would appreciate it if we would introduce it for a further look this session.
That's the English system, basically?
I believe so. LC-2192 prevents use of law enforcement agency written policies, procedures, rules, or guidelines as evidence of negligence in civil actions other than in disciplinary proceedings between agency and its employees. LC-2255 establishes schedule of minimum dollar amounts that may be set by a court as condition to security relief. The minimum amount varies with classification of offense for which the defendant is charged. Next one increases from $100 to blank dollars the amount which the court may require the plaintiff in a writ of review proceeding to give as undertaking for costs and disbursements that may be adjudged to defendant on review. Authorizes court to award reasonable attorney fees and necessary costs and disbursements to prevailing party in writ of review proceeding. That's LC-691. The next one, which was drafted, by the Metropolitan Public Defender. I'm not sure there have been so many, but I believe this is a public defender. LC-1858 deletes restitution as a possible condition of probation and authorizes payment of any fine imposed to victim of crime. Authorizes court to impose up to $5,000 fine on conviction for unclassified felony in which no fine is specified. Requires court to consider rehabilitative effect on defendant of payment and method of payment of fine. That's a somewhat different approach to restitution, but one that we just want to include in the package I think we're going to look at. Let's take this group separately. Is there any objection to the committee introduction of these bills?
Well, this one, we didn't admit this one.
All right, okay, we'll consider that out of the group. That first vote excludes
LC-1990.
Okay. For discussion purposes, the chair moves that he be authorized to introduce LC-1990 as a committee bill. That's the one relating to prior history of sexual conduct.
The women's group's attorneys did participate in the drafting of this?
Yes.
Question?
Any objections to the motion? Approved. Mr. Wilson?
Myers?
The next bill is LC-1590 from Chuck Wilson. And the summary, transfers authority to issue permit to carry concealed handgun from sheriff to Department of State Police, prescribes qualifications for applicants seeking permits, increases fees for issuance and renewal of permits from $10 to $250 respectively to $20 and $15, requires dealers to send a copy of register of sale of handgun to local law enforcement agency and Department of State Police, requires local law enforcement agency to notify a dealer within 10-day waiting period whether purchaser is qualified to complete purchase. Directs licensing authorities of city or county to issue licenses to sell handguns at retail. Creates separate crime of owning or possessing a machine gun, punishable by maximum term of 5 years in prison, $2,500 fine or both. Creates separate crime of transporting handgun in vehicle without permit, punishable by maximum term of imprisonment for 1 year, fine of $1,000. Mr. Wilson would like to introduce this as a committee bill.
Is this Mr. Wilson's bill or is this...
Is this your bill, Mr. Wilson?
Yes.
Any objection to the introduction?
Mr. Chairman, I do, and I think I alluded to it with Tuck, but I'll say it for the record. I don't know what my position is on the merits, but I do recall several times during my last two election campaigns talking to people about the issue that's involved here, and I feel as a matter of personal commitments that I've made to them that I couldn't go through the introduction of it without having discussed it with them and the groups that they are part of before. So I'd simply have to vote no, which doesn't indicate a substantive position, but just my feeling, my own commitments.
I have a question.
Representative Richards?
Is the permit authority now the county sheriff?
Yes.
And you would change the permit authority to the state police?
Yes.
Would that be more or less accessible?
The same. The state police have offices in all 36 counties. They would issue through their regional offices.
And as a matter of record or matter of habit now, are the county sheriffs responding to the request for whether or not the person can purchase the gun?
Representative Richards, there are approximately 7,000 permits outstanding. These permits, when issued, are good statewide for a period of 1 year. There are some counties, like Multnomah, that will issue none. There are other counties that will issue them virtually to anyone who applies. The state does not have a uniform practice, nor does the statute provide standards to guide the issuing officer in determining when to reject or when to issue. As a result, there is litigation pending against a number of county sheriffs who have refused to issue.
What are the standards that you, that are proposed?
Good cause, present standard. In this bill, it says that the person must meet the minimum requirements under the federal law to be sold a firearm at all. That is to say, it cannot be currently under indictment or have been convicted of a previous felony involving a firearm. And in addition, they must demonstrate a need for the handgun, and that the handgun in their possession would be reasonably suited to that purpose. It also provides for a contested case hearing in the event of a denial, and an appeal to the Court of Appeals under the APA.
What is the scope of need? How is need defined? I've got problems too, Mr. Chairman, in terms of the wide number of ramifications in the legislation.
Comment, Mr. Chairman.
President Buis.
Well, I don't think when you're talking about any kind of change in the gun laws in the state that any of us does not have a problem. I think the position here, and this comes under the heading of explain your vote before you vote, but I strongly believe that the bill has a right to be heard, so I'm going to vote for it.
Okay, well, if Representative Richards has a problem in the sense of voting aye, we're down to four votes in terms of majority of the committee. Let me ask Representative Frommeyer, Representative Richards, is your position affected if the bill is shown to be introduced at the request of Lyndon A.S. Wilson, Jr.?
Nope. That would eliminate my problem as a Judiciary Committee member.
Do you have any objection to that, Chuck?
Yeah.
I'm trying to do the question of five votes to introduce the bill.
If we were to have a call of the committee, would the rest of the committee come?
Well, the committee has been called. I don't know where they are.
I left that note there for you to find.
Okay. The court can't seem to reach either Kulongoski or Blumenauer.
Mr. Chairman,
can I ask you a question, Mr. Chairman? Can you say that one more? Do I understand that the committee note bills may be introduced at any time after the deadline?
If the bill has been submitted to legislative council prior to 5 o'clock today, as I understand it, it may be introduced after today. Because I'm not sure about the status of a bill we've actually physically received and not actually had introduction today. A bill that's being drafted today, which is received after today, can be introduced by a committee with the leave of the speaker, or by an individual with leave of the Legislative Operations and Procedures Committee. I'm not sure what the status is of a bill we physically have before 5 o'clock today and know to act on.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Richards.
According to the chief clerk with whom I checked this very question yesterday, the 3 days runs from receipt of the Legislative Council draft, the extension, by the author, whoever requested the draft.
3-day extension?
Yeah.
Is there a 3-day extension?
If you exercise a priority.
Oh, a priority. Okay. No, but that's...
Member privilege.
But that's in terms of getting the bill back.
It's in terms of introduction into the House of Representatives.
Mr. Chairman, if I might just say one thing more. Obviously, I'm reluctant to stigmatize the bill and doom it in advance with my name on it. But if that's the only way I have to go, of course, then I think it's important that the bill be introduced. The present law was passed in 1925 and with minor tinkering is the same law that you have today. It is filled with holes. For example, with the exception of the unincorporated area of Multnomah County, all of the handgun dealers of the state of Oregon are presently guilty of a misdemeanor under the drafting of the present law. Why? Because the cities and the counties have not issued the licenses required of them by the statute, and I can say that categorically, having pulled them all. And as you go through the statute, you can take section by section and find that the present law is not connecting. It is not effective. I have been told that the Attorney General is prepared to come before this committee and to explain to this committee that the question is whether we're going to have some regulation of firearms in the state or none, because at the present time, we simply don't have any. It's a popular conception that there is a 120-hour waiting period from the time of the sale to the time of delivery, but that is a myth. It only applies to those dealers who are licensed, and the only licensed dealers are in the unincorporated area of Multnomah County that passed a licensing ordinance 1 month ago.
I don't think anyone in the committee is raising a question about whether there are provisions of this bill that should be seriously considered. The problem is very simple. With your name on, there are apparently enough folks introduced it as a committee bill at your request. Without your name, haven't got enough. So it boils down to that, and we're running up on the deadline for introduction of bills, period. Do you have any advice?
If I have time, Mr. Chairman, at least make it Lyndon Tocqueville.
Well, with respect to your remark about dooming the bill in advance, you know, your name on it may draw more attention than it would otherwise have gotten, although I don't think that's the case, given the scope and the basis of the bill. But this is the committee, I would assume, to which the bill is going to come. And whether your name is on it or not on it, I don't think that's going to affect whether it's passed or not passed. That's all I can say.
Thank you.
Well, the chair interpreted the position of Representative Richards to be that she would endorse the committee position. I'm being presumptuous, though. I haven't talked to the other members of the committee. I may not have five votes.
Why don't you call the roll on that?
All right. Let's take it that there's a motion before us to introduce the bill at the request of Lyndon Tuck Wilson. Clerk will call the roll.
Representative Buegen?
Aye.
Schoenmeyer?
No.
Lombard?
Aye.
Richards?
Aye.
Rutherford?
No.
Gardner?
Aye.
Meyer?
Aye. At four?
Five.
Five aye?
Five aye, two no.
Great. I explain mine also.
Yeah.
I would take the same position that Representative Buegas does. That is simply without expressing an opinion at all on the merits of the bill. In fact, I have some great doubts in my own mind of my support of the bill. I do feel that it's entitled to have a hearing.
Now I've put on the record my remarks.
Representative Rutherford?
My reasons for voting no are the same as those that caused me to vote against the proposal to introduce a revision of the ERA amendment some days ago.
Further comments? Representative Gardner?
I would say that my reasons for voting for the bill are the same reasons that I voted for the ERA amendment the other day, which are that I believe that any idea is at least entitled for a fair hearing, and there are enough turkeys flying around here that one person is going to make much difference.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Butler.
I believe I already explained my vote, but I'll do it again. I made personal commitments to several people with respect to this type of issue, and I believe that I would be deemed a hypocrite if I did it otherwise, even though I look at the bill on its merits when it comes before us.
Well, I think it's a fair statement for the record that all the members who voted affirmatively for introduction are passing no judgment at this point on any individual or total provision of the bill. We'll look at it when it comes in. Mr. Wilson.
Thanks, Captain.
Mr. Meyer, you had some bills.
Yes, I do. The first one of them is LC 1665, which is the fourth part of the products liability package that was inadvertently omitted when I discussed it with you before, and I request that be omitted, or be admitted, introduced by the committee.
Did you give the LC number?
Yes, 1665. The second one is a bill that declares that it's LC 1306, declares the specified staff services constituting patient care performed by staff employees at the medical center or within the scope of state employment, provides for indemnification of the liability fund. This is similar to, but a different version of, an earlier malpractice bill that's been introduced by the committee dealing with the question of the peculiar problems of liability of the doctors in the Health Sciences Center who also have outside practices.
Can I ask a question with regard to that, Mr. Chairman? I won't hold it up.
Representative Ugas,
is it possible, do you think, Mr. Brown, that that bill might be amended without damage to it to include the malpractice problems or the insurance problems that relate to hospitals, local hospitals?
I don't think that this has a broad enough bill title to do that, although other bills coming back to the committee certainly do. And there are several that deal specifically with malpractice issues.
I've been contacted during the weekend on this point, but that's all I have.
Yeah.
Representative Frohnmeyer moves the chairman be authorized to introduce the bills. He's just reviewed his committee bills.
He's got another one.
I have one.
Big point.
Yeah. You may wish to take those. Those are sort of run of the mill. I'm getting more exotic now. The next bill.
You need to start listening more carefully.
No, no. I really believe in full disclosure to this committee, and I won't try to run one something by anybody. But I think those, if you could vote on those, then we could get to this separately.
No objections to the motion relating to the bills just
discussed.
I have
a question before we get the gavel down there. Could Representative Frohnmeyer tell me how many bills he's introduced and under his own name?
At least this many.
Okay.
Further questions? Further discussion? Any objections to the motion?
LC 2227 would prohibit a rental car company from requiring a customer to have a credit card. It would exclude rental car companies who disclose the requirement of a credit card in advance in their advertisements. It permits a customer to bring an action against a violating company and recover actual damages.
Okay. Motion to authorize introduction of that as a committee bill. Any objections? Did you give the LC number on there?
Yes, it is. 2227.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, if you might. The next is a package of about four bills. LC 479, LC 576, and LC 616. Deal with a fundamental revision of the condominium law of the state of Oregon. This is the product of the Condominium Study Committee of the Association of Oregon Realtors, of some consumer groups, and it's attempting to be a complete package revision of the condominium law.
Is it going to be shown at their request?
It could be shown at the request of the Condominium Study Committee or Oregon Association of Realtors, if you prefer. I have no
doubt. That's an awfully broad subject. I wonder, would that be the committee's feeling? You might want to have
it's fine
to request bill.
And if the committee is unhappy about it, I could drop it myself, but it seems to me it would get a better hearing this way.
I think if it's at the request, it's well.
Yes. I have no objection.
Would you mind entering that on the backers? Well, let me take a vote. Is there any objection to the introduction at the request of the organization?
You did say there are, excuse me, Mr. Chin. You did say there were some condominium owners involved in the
Well, there were condominium tenants. It was at my insistence that they include a consumer representative who was a law professor on the subject.
Okay, and how about, and the builders? You said
the builders were represented, sellers were represented, consumer group was represented.
Any objection to introduction?
You have any more?
That is it. Thank you.
Did you give the LCs on those?
Yes, I did.
Any other bills from the members of the committee? Okay, the last item of business is the visit to the penitentiary with the lifers. 15th and the 22nd are the dates that have been suggested. Is the committee able to tell me at this point?
Wednesday night, Mr. Chairman.
Tuesday.
It's Tuesdays, actually.
Tuesday.
Now, we can do it this way. If you want to check, we have a work session tomorrow. If you'd like to be able to come tomorrow prepared to say which of those dates would be preferable, we could report back to the penitentiary tomorrow. That might be able to serve the members.
May I indicate my preference now?
Yes.
For the
22nd? 22nd, here too.
All right, Dennis, if you mind noting that, at least those two.
22nd's fine.
Representative Lombard's available on the 22nd.
I think so. I want to check myself.
Why don't you, maybe we need to committee check that and be prepared to comment tomorrow.
Would you contact
Blumenauer, Kielengoski, and tell him we'd like to know about that at the meeting tomorrow? The other thing in that connection, too, is that the lifers would like to know what it is we want to hear when we go out there. So I'd like the members of the committee to be considering that, and perhaps if it takes a few minutes tomorrow or at some full committee meeting between now and the time we go out a few days before, to pull together some suggestions and send those out to them. Yes?
Mr. Chairman, you and Mark and Dave are not expressing any opinion on the 22nd.
I have my calendar here, Dennis. I'm sorry.
Unless they hear otherwise from the 22nd.
I think that's going to be all right with me. I got this call about 2 before I walked up here and didn't have a chance to look at my calendar.
Mr. Chairman, I have a letter from Mr. John Malott. Are you going to hear that from the county extension agent?
I'll handle that
separately. Fine.
Individual contact. Any further business? During the 1:30 hour.